Blog Talk Radio.
Here with Thomas Fortenberry, waiting for the storm to hit.
Yeah, picking up outside.
Oh,
or are we talking about that,
Yeah, well, we're
other
storm. We're talking about that storm, too. I did a show last night, a special show, for the Notre School of the Arts, and it was unbelievable. The storm, I got text messages and email messages from Blog Talk Radio and from Skype that they were having problems. The storm was raising hell wherever they were, and it was terrible. The connection was wobbly. I'm going to have to cut and paste that, and I couldn't get it done. And I said, I was so tired. I said, you know, just like Michael Corleone, when I got out, I thought I was finished, and they pulled me right back in. I was getting ready to go to bed for the first time before 2 o'clock. And what happened was the shootout on MSNBC. What are you doing out here? I said, oh, yeah, the guy showed it out the window. Bam, 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 explosion. They caught these two idiots that did the bombing. One gets shot, run over by his brother. gets Brother blasts through the barricade, gets away to get a massive search. I was up to a quarter to five this morning watching this on TV. I said, what, am I insane? This is ludicrous. This is just ludicrous.
That's what breaking news does to you, Mike.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, it is unbelievable. So we're going to have a great show. Matter of fact, I don't even know if we've got time to get through all of it, but I want to get through, and I had a paper here that has it all written down on it. And I don't know. How I label them, I don't know. Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know. Third base.
Well,
but.
So we're going to be talking about a lot of these.
Yeah, I have that, but
what
I have something else. I had a written thing that I was going to go because we had. Oh, David. Because we got so much stuff to talk about.
Oh, man, we got
that's
stuff.
And we don't want to do news. Because I want to get through some of this stuff. We had a convention here, a Democratic convention.
Yep.
Last Saturday. And I went there to interview some of the people. I got some great, we got some great candidates and whatnot. And, I'm not going to go through the people who ran for office and lost. We don't have time.
Mm. Sure.
But, I am going to go through, some of the people who did win. I'm going to interview some of them, and one of them is a young lady, and her name is Tori Boldware. She is now the secretary for the Democratic Party in Mecklenburg County. If I can find her. Oh, yeah, I see that. Matter of fact, let me send this stuff out to these people who are listening. And okay, so I'm going to play this young lady. The first time I met her, she ran against Tawana Daniels for secretary.
Okay.
And Tawana, I know her, and Tawana, I'm going to ask you to come on the show because I don't have time to play her interview because there's so much breaking news today. The SWAT team, we want to get to that. We want to get to Jackie Robinson. We want to get to a lot of stuff. So I'm going to play this. This short 4-minute piece that I and her name is Tora, T-O-R-I-A-C, Boldware. And she is now the new secretary for the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party.
Okay, I am here with a young lady who is running for
secretary of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party.
And your name is?
Tora C. Boldware.
And Tora, is that T-O-R-I? A, okay. Why do you need to be on the board?
Well, I definitely want to make sure that we continue to have transparency in in the Democratic Party, because people are really excited in Mecklenburg County. We want to make sure that we hold ourselves accountable and make sure that you have a group of people on the board, including myself, that hold our politicians accountable, because we elect them. And what we're going to do as a board is to make sure that we get good Democrats elected to positions so that we can prosper as a party. We've got to take back the state, House, take back the Senate. We just got to take back Raleigh, period, and make sure that we keep Mecklenburg County blue.
Now, how does electing a good board here in Mecklenburg help the state party?
Oh, well, because if you have a good board, you have people that are really willing to work, willing to go out and make sure that we have good good candidates. You have people engaged and ready to give money to the party so that you can get these candidates out there, raise funds. That's like one of the biggest things. And if you have a board that you can count on, a board that you know is going to help facilitate everything, then you're going to be able to encourage people to be involved. So the better the board, the better the involvement within the community, the better involvement in the community, the more visibility we have.
Now, what position did you hold before you started seeking this position?
Oh, well, I've held a couple of positions. I was started as the secretary of the Young Democrats of Mecklenburg County, and I am the former president of the Young Democrats of Mecklenburg County. I've served as chair as of the Young Democrats of North Carolina Women's Caucus and current SEC member. And I'm actually the North Carolina Democratic Party credentials and appeals representative from the 9th District.
And where do you, are you a chairperson of any precincts, or what other positions do you hold in the Democratic Party?
Well, I did help organize my precinct, Precinct 80, prior to moving. Rosa Mustafa is now the precinct chair of that. And after this convention, I'm actually going to work on getting my precinct organized in my new community.
And what precinct would that be?
38.
And what area does that cover?
That is Woodlawn Park, South Charlotte.
Okay, and how big an area is that?
It's a pretty big area, and my precinct is actually a Democratic precinct, but it's one of the few in that area. It's one of the precincts that did go to Martha Alexander when she unfortunately lost her reelection. But it's a good Democratic precinct, and so we do have to work there and kind of work our way out to some of the non-Democratic precincts in the area.
Now, I'm going to try to be precise in this question, because when I ask you what changes you'd like to see in the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party, that can take in a wide area. So try to be a little focused.
Okay, well, just as far as changes, I just want to make sure that there's more transparency, and anyone that's active in the Democratic Party who wants information, they can come to the secretary, come to anybody on the board and say, I was unable to come to this meeting. What happened? Why did this happen? Or what was the reasoning for voting on that? And as secretary, I will be able to take quality notes, quality minutes, so that at any point in time, someone can come to me and say, what happened on May 11th, 2013? And I can say, this is what happened.
Now, tell us again what position you're running for and your name, and how can people come to you if they have any questions?
Well, again, I am Toria C. Boldware. I am running for Secretary of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party, and I can always be reached via telephone 704-877-9667 or via email T.C. Boldware, T as in Tom, C as in Charlie, Boldware, B-O-L-D-W-A-R-E @gmail.com.
I want to thank you, Toria. Michael Lawson, interview with Jeff Jackson, who's the Precinct 2 Chair and is running for...
Third Vice Chair of Mecklenburg County Democratic Party.
And Jeff, how long have you been in Charlotte?
I've been in Charlotte about 3 years. I moved here for work, and I work as a criminal prosecutor.
And where'd you move from?
Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Oh, you don't sound like you have a Chapel Hill or North Carolinian accent.
Well, I can't explain that.
So have you always been involved in politics, or is this something that you did while you went to school?
It's something that's been growing over time. The 2008 campaign, I think, brought in a lot of people my age, a lot of recent college graduates. I got sucked in by all the excitement there, and it's been building ever since.
You are the precinct chair of Precinct 2, and where is that physically located?
That's in Elizabeth. It's down Randolph Road, kind of across from the Mint Museum.
Okay, and what is your idea of why people need to participate in the democratic process?
Well, that would be the newspapers that we've seen come out, all of the really disturbing news over the last few weeks and few months. Elections have severe consequences, and we are bearing the brunt of not putting up a strong enough fight in the last election. We lost in Mecklenburg County some very close races that could make a difference in Raleigh. We could really have a stronger position in the fight for equal pay, equal rights, if we had a more dedicated effort to get local Democrats elected. I think it's obvious to everybody the consequences of the last election. We need to work to regain our footing.
What are some of the problems you've seen in your, especially around your area in Precinct 2, that need to be addressed?
Precinct 2 is an interesting development issue right now, where you can see very wide income disparity, where you've got a few sections of very nice homes, a lot of it's a neighborhood that's in transition. And a lot of these people are brand new to Charlotte. One of the things that the Democratic Party needs to do is reach out to newcomers to Charlotte, because a lot of these people are looking for ways to get involved. And the first people who reach them are going to get their efforts and ultimately get their votes. So a neighborhood like that should be a very strong Democratic neighborhood.
Okay, and now this is your first opportunity to run for an elected position, is that correct?
Yeah, my first interview.
Well, we're just full of firsts today. How did you decide to run for this position?
Well, I've been helping out with some fundraisers and going to a few events, and some people told me there was going to be some change of leadership in the next election for the party, and I looked at the different positions and what their job duties were. The third vice chair, their job is to get out the message. That's the communications guy, and that plays to my strengths and what I enjoy doing. I'm a criminal prosecutor. I spend a lot of time building cases and making strong arguments and trying to get a message across to people. So I thought that might be something that I could actually do well. I'm going to give it a shot.
Well, you know, we need new enlightenment in the party. We if we stay the same, we'll be like the GOP. And we are the changing party. We're changing according to the development of the people in the communities, how the communities develop. That's the only way we change. So I wish you all the luck today. Did anybody run against you?
The best part is no.
What? See, that is the best way to run for office.
In every single auxiliary meeting last week, the Democratic Hispanics, Democratic women, senior Democrats, young Democrats, I'm campaigning like I got 30 people running against me.
And I got an email from you, too.
Hey, you got two emails.
Oh, I got two.
Don't short me one.
Well, hey, you know, I got 250 emails a day. So when I see the first one, I check that one off. Okay, thank you, Jeff.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck today.
And right now, I want to get our county commissioner.
Okay. This is Michael Lawson, Saturday, April the 13th, 2013, and we are at Elizabeth Traditional School in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we are here with a young lady named Vi Alexander Lyles, who is running for the City Council at Large. Say hello.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. The last word is a great thing to do. I'm running for City Council at Large. It's going to be a contested seat in both the primary and the general election. And my name is Vi Alexander Lyles. I'm asking for your support. I think I'm uniquely qualified for this position because I have experience in budget and finance. I actually wrote the city's first capital budget, so I don't know why we can't pass one now, because we passed one then. I've also facilitated a number of community issues, and I am connected in the business community locally and regionally, and really believe that we can bring this city back with economic development and jobs. So again, I'm Vi Alexander Lyles, and I ask for your vote and support.
Now, when you say bring the city back from where?
You know, we experienced the Great Recession. We're experiencing real pressures from the state. They're trying to take the airport. They're trying to limit the authority of cities. And what?
And they you mean the Regressive Party?
I really mean the current state legislature led by the Republicans as well as our governor. And that, I think, is going to hurt Charlotte. We're an urban center. We are the economic engine in this region, and I think that we deserve respect for that.
Well, I understand that the Edgar Starnes up there and Tillis want to bring Charlotte back to Mayberry. I believe, the 17th largest, 18th largest city in the country now. So we cannot go back to Mayberry.
You can never go back. You always have to be thinking about going forward, and that's why I'm running. I really believe in going forward. We've come out of the Great Recession. Now it's time to build on the opportunities. We're going to be the best city in the region to come and locate for jobs. We're going to be the best city to live in, and that's what's important, and that's why I'm running for city council.
Now, also, with the Regressive Party up in Raleigh, they are planning so many seizures down here. They want to take the airport, they want to change how the schools operate, who owns the schools, to put it in private hands, and pretty soon there won't be anything that's publicly operated in the major urban cities.
And I think that's a real mistake, because the people on the ground have the knowledge and the skills. We've run an airport since it was a place where you had to walk out of like a little shed over and take your bags and walk across the pavement to get on the airplane. Look at what we've got now. That is the sixth largest, busiest airport in the country. We have not made any mistakes in running our airport. So sometimes I really question what is the real reason for some of the actions being taken. And I think that we have to have a city council prepared to act on that, to make sure that when there's something that's going on, that we're ready to challenge it and defend this position. This is a great city. We shouldn't be on the defensive at all about it. But if we have to, we're going to do it with the best.
Well, as majority leader for the Democrats in the House, Dwight Hall said yesterday on my show, he said that Edgar Starnes said, we were elected, we don't care what you think about it, and we're not going to apologize. So what we need to do is to get more people involved in what is really going up there in Raleigh, and what we can do to help prevent that takeover down here in Charlotte.
I think the most important thing for us to do is to get out and vote and elect people like me that really want to be there. Because when you think about it, those folks that are arguing against us, they weren't elected by the citizens of Charlotte. They are elected in these bedroom communities around us. They're really kind of living off of the success of this community. We've got to keep that success, and we've got to be positive about it. At the same time, you know, what your mom says is, you know, keep your enemies closer. Friends close, enemies closer. We got to get these folks closer to understand the drivers in Charlotte that make the difference. I can do that.
Okay, so tell us how we can get in touch with you, how we can help you in any way, and where you're running and what you're running for.
I am Vi Alexander Lowes, running for Charlotte City Council at large. My website is Vote Vi Alexander Lowes. Vote Vi Alexander Lowes. Google it, come on. I ask people for their vote. I ask you to get 25 other people to vote for me. And if you want to send me a donation, go to the website and do it. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you. And that's it here from Charlotte Traditional.
Okay, now, that was Bri. She has a lot of things to give to this this party. She has been involved in a lot.
Yeah, but I love her energy.
Oh, she does. She has a lot of energy, and she has a fabulous smile. So I think there's a lot there that's going to help this party. Next up is Dumont Clark.
Our Dumont.
Yes. And Dumont was there, and as always, he provided us with a lot of insight into what's really going on. So let's listen, Dumont.
I am here with, so at the convention, with one of our county commissioners, a longtime county commissioner, Dumont Clark, and what is going on the county commission is if I didn't know.
Well, it's been a very interesting, we have a lot of newcomers, several newcomers. The chair is brand new, hasn't served in an elected office before. Trevor Fuller is new, and Kim Ratliff is new. And then we have some veterans, so it's a good mixture with a lot of new blood and people with asking a lot of the questions, it's a good mixture of old and veterans and new.
Well, you know, when you say you ask a lot of questions, you know, it's just like when you go to the doctor. Do you ask the right questions?
I think people are asking a lot of the right questions. Yes, I do. I think that I think sometimes it's important to be prepared to listen to the answers and not just ask the questions. One of the things I've noticed, Michael, about elected officials is when they're given the opportunity to ask questions, most of them, including myself, choose to make statements. Sometimes in the form of questions.
Their position.
But generally, you know, they want to make their comments and their position known. So
well, but a lot of new people that are on the county commission now were not elected officials before. And you would think that they would come with the same idea as the people who are in the hinterlands or in the precincts, that they'd want to ask those same questions. Do you feel that they're doing that, or are they asking questions that a politician would ask?
No, I actually think they're really asking a lot of good questions, trying to understand county government and understand one of the most challenging parts of serving in Mecklenburg County, anyway, is that we have so many consolidated functions between the city and the county that I think it's very difficult for the people, including newly elected officials, sometimes to understand the relationships between the city and the county and which one does what, you know.
Yes, thank you.
And we've really complicated matters because we've named things like the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Utilities, and actually Mecklenburg County has nothing to do with it. We have a police department called the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. We don't oversee their budget at all. But
see his thing that I came from from New York, large city. The place that I lived in East Elmhurst probably has more people than Mecklenburg County. And the thing is, this is now the 17th or the 18th largest, well, Charlotte is the 17th or 18th largest city in the country. Am I correct?
I wouldn't trust myself on a statistic like that, but it is certainly one of the largest cities in the country. What it really is really one of the largest metropolitan statistical regions. I mean, when you look at the region, which includes, I serve on the road planning organization here called the MPO. We're getting ready to expand it to include not all of Mecklenburg, about half, the eastern half of Union County, and the southern half or two-thirds of Iredell County. And so you really see, you know, you see the expansion of the population going north up 77, going east on Independence, and then going west on 85. I mean, this region probably has 1.5 million people in it or more right now.
Well, what about the idea that it is just too cumbersome and we need, there's too many cross functions. You know, people want to know, it's almost like the Abbott Costello routine, like who's on first. I mean, the city council does this, the county commission does this, the board does this, and you know, and the mayor does nothing but look. I mean, it's a weak mayorship. And what is your idea, and what do you think about having it consolidated to one city council with a city council president and the mayor at the head? And the mayor is the one who's hung by the thumbs if something goes wrong.
Well, if you're going to hang him by his thumbs, you got to give him a little more power than he currently has if things go wrong.
Absolutely.
Now, yeah, I've thought about this issue, particularly of consolidation of city-county government for a long time, and I think the most compelling reason to do it, I don't think we'd save a lot of money. I think we might save a little, but not a lot. But the most compelling reason to do it is I think it would leave citizens would know there's one government responsible for government services, and people like me would not be able to say when citizens come up with a concern about parking or their water bill, you know, I can always just say, oh, go talk to your city council, and they're like, why should I talk to them? You know, this is Charlotte Mecklenburg Utilities.
Well,
you should know about it. I'm saying I don't know anything about it because I pay a water bill like you do. But
right. Well, see, this is and it's really confusing with someone that comes from a big city like I have, where they have this consolidation, and to me, it's just more efficient. This is my estimation. I know Mayor Fox was thinking about that, but how do you think the rest of the people in the county commission feel about it?
Well, I really don't know because this county commission has not discussed the topic or the issue, and it's a lot of people are new, and it just really hasn't come up as an issue for us. The previous commission, which was not really supportive of consolidation, and here I'll give you the other side of it, and that is, I think the reason not to do it is that I do believe the county functions are quite different from the cities, and I think as an elected county commissioner, I can focus on what the county does. If I had to do, as an elected official, focus on everything the city and the county does, it would be more than a full-time job.
Well, and you need to get paid more also. That's the other thing.
I would, if it had to be a full-time job, yes. I mean, right now it's a nighttime job.
what are, and you know, for some of the people who are listening and don't know what the county commission does, What does the county commission do?
Well, the county, it's, well, the biggest thing we do is we set about $1.4 billion budget each year for the county, but about half of that money goes to support our school system, either through buildings or through supplementing the operating budget of the school system, which comes primarily from the state of North Carolina.
Is that teacher salaries too?
Well, we do supplement salaries, but teachers are almost all state employees, and we add a supplement to the salary they get from the state. Some teachers are fully funded by the county, so it's a combination of the two.
Now, if the city council, how is it determined, and who determines where that line is between the city council and a county commission? How does someone call up and say, I don't know who to speak to? How do they, is there an ombudsman? Is there somebody they can go to and say, help me out, who do I go to?
Well, I think most elected officials can give you pretty quickly, you know, answers to whether it's a city or an elected. And I always say, you know, do talk to your city council representative or talk to your county commissioner. And then 311 is a great service. You know, they know if you have a problem as a citizen, you call 311 and you explain your problem. They know where to send you.
How long have you been now on the county commission?
I have been serving since 2000, Michael, and I'm very grateful for having had the privilege of doing it. I think I'm the longest serving, I know I'm the longest serving Democrat on the county commission. I'm serving, I think the only commissioner who's served longer than I have is Mr. Bill James.
And we will leave that at that. But
I have one other common bond, however, which I will let you know about, and that is his oldest child and my oldest child are both officers in the United States Navy.
Oh, very good. Very good.
So we trade hats with each other.
If people want to speak to you, how can they get a hold of you? What's your email address, contact information?
Oh, boy. Probably the best way to reach me is my cell phone, 704-996-6126.
And I want to thank you. This has been Dumont Clark.
Yep, you're welcome.
And County Commission.
Great interview.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Dumont Clark. And I'll tell you what, Dumont is a worker. So you get a hold of him, he will get things done.
That's what it's about.
That's what it's about.
Unlike that, I'll mention right here, unlike that other fool we might get to, that senator recently made news in North Carolina.
Yeah, right.
Who doesn't seem to understand that working for the people, part of his job. But we'll get to that.
That's right. I was elected. I'm going to do what I want to do. I don't care what you think, and I'm not going to apologize.
Yeah.
Mr. Edward Starnes, Republican in the House. Well,
and that's even a different one than the other guy was.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
But
there's plenty of them.
Tommy Turner.
Oh,
with his recent
statement. Oh yeah, we're gonna get to him.
I'm the senator. You're the citizen.
Shut up. Next up, we have District 5 City Council Member John Autry, my City Council Member. Let's see what he has to say.
Michael Lawson, an interview with, just tell us, everybody, what your name is.
My name is John Autry. I represent District 5 on the Charlotte City Council.
Now, everybody who lives in Charlotte knows John Autry. He has been a fixture here forever in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, tell us, you've been on the City Council for how long now?
A year and a half.
And what have you done? Of course, well, we can't go that way because you have done so much. But what are you planning on doing to straighten the city council out? Only like you can do.
Well, trust me, if I had a magic bullet that would solve that issue, I believe I would have played that already. But I think it's really exposing the other members to real hard data that supports the agenda for this moving this city forward. We're not going to be able to grow our tax base any longer by annexation. That bridge has been demolished.
Closed.
Not closed, demolished. and by the state legislature. So how do we continue to grow? Because Charlotte is the fastest growing municipal area in the country today. And if we aren't out in front of this growth, we're going to be playing catch up for way too long, and it'll cost us a lot more in the long run. So, for instance, the streetcar project, or as I like to call East-West Rail Transit for Charlotte, last year was $119 million for the 2.5 mile segment. If it gets approved this year, it would be $126 million. And it's not going to go down anymore.
Well, but you know, you're right. Every year it goes up. But we now have a regressive governor in our state. What is his outlook on a streetcar?
Well, you know, the streetcar just didn't appear out of thin air in the last couple of years. It was actually part of the 2030 transit plan that was approved when Governor McCrory was Mayor McCrory. So it's part of the transit plan that his council approved. So I think if you saw the Observer today, here we are on Saturday, April 13th, we saw in the Observer this morning that the task force that the Metropolitan Transit Commission has been looking into how to fund the rest of the transit system. We've got a lot more of this transit system that has to be built out. A transit system is not just a line that runs north and south. A transit system has to reach all the sectors of the city. But also, these kinds of transit projects have been shown to be very transformative in the communities that they go through. And we also have another challenge in the city, in that most of the tax revenue that the city relies on comes from what we call the Southern Wedge. That runs from Center City down to South Charlotte. And if we aren't going to do something to help lift up the other parts of the community that are unperforming, that is an unsustainable situation.
Well, here's the question I have. Does he remember this was part of the project that he put together?
Well, sir, I would say to you that you may know people who have better access to him than I do, so give them the opportunity to respond to that.
Well, you see, because it seems to me that since he became governor, he has now become Darth Vader.
That's an interesting way to put that. I would say that the hopes that a lot of the voters in North Carolina had, that moderate Mayor McCrory would be moderate Governor McCrory, have been dashed within the first 100 days.
And you know, the thing is that I had the Democratic leader of the House, Larry Hall, on my show yesterday, and he said it is unbelievable out there. This guy Edgar Starnes is, well, in my estimation, not Larry Hall's estimation, is a complete moron. The things that he wants to do are so outlandish. People need to start looking out their windows, because things could change very quickly if the Regressive Party in Raleigh wants to start pushing all their, well, there's about 8 or 9 different projects.
Well, if you're looking for insight on what the state legislature has next up, the majority in the state legislature has up its sleeves for the citizens of North Carolina next, all you have to do is go to the ALEC website and look at their agenda. It's pretty darn clear what's going to be next. They want to seize public infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, utility infrastructure. For instance, I understand there was a bill introduced yesterday to take over the water resources for the city of Asheville. They're looking to take away the airport from the city of Charlotte.
The school
systems. You can understand that, you know, turning the state of North Carolina into heaven compared to Ayn Rand's vision is probably not the best, most forward way of thinking for any state to be considered. But that's the hand that we're dealing with. But we have to remember, Michael, that in 2010, we let this happen.
Absolutely correct.
We let this happen.
That's correct.
Now, elections have consequences. And if you don't think they do, You're not paying attention to what's happening in Raleigh right now.
Well, listen, I say this on my show every single time I have my show. We are the problem why we're in this position now in 2010 when the people did not go out and vote. They elected the first black Democratic president, and they thought there was going to be a chicken in every pot. Well, there was no chicken because they didn't have a pot.
Well, I would go a little bit further. I'd probably go home and chain your stove to your kitchen. Look. We knew this was going to be challenging for all of us. And being in North Carolina, where we're not a home rule state, we have Dillon's rule, the whole city of Charlotte only exists at the pleasure of the North Carolina legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you look around and look at other cities that are being, where council and the mayor are being sent home, for instance, some municipalities in the state of Michigan, and the governor appoints an administrator to run that operation, that's not impossible to happen here in North Carolina. Plus, Charlotte is a blue eye in a red state. And there are efforts to turn that blue eye black. And so you pound it from this angle, you pound it from that angle, and away you go. But, you know...
Well, it's got to be done in the next 10 years because this state will... is, and just like the rest of the country is going to be a minority-majority state by 2026 or 2025. So these people are trying to throw everything against the wall that they can because their time is running out.
Well, you know, if you can disenfranchise enough voters, if you can put more obstacles between the poll and the voter, your chances of maintaining power are much more improved. But, you see... that's just acquiescing that they can't win on the issues.
That's right.
They have to, you know, I'm not worried about voter fraud. I'm worried about election fraud. And, you know, we have laws that protect elections. And if there was a case enough made, you know, I want to make decisions about policy based on tangible, actionable, hard data. There is no data to support voter ID and restricting. I mean, telling students if you're registered with your, you know, and your parents are receiving it. I mean, this is all craziness, and it's going to hurt the state's ability to bring business to the state. It's going to hurt the state's ability to be prepared for what the future has for us. But I mean, if you believe, if you're of the mindset that, you know, with the passing of Margaret Thatcher last week, one of the quotes that kept showing up was her quote about there is no society, there's only profit in the individual. You know, look, none of us got where we are today by pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
That's not what Anne Rice said.
No, that's what Thurgood Marshall said. And there is no way that people are going to... be able to allow what's happening in Raleigh go unnoticed. And whenever you have this much power consolidated with one sector of politics, they can't help themselves but overreach. And in overreaching like that, people will take notice and say, wait just a doggone minute. What the heck is going on here? And what are the long-range ramifications of this stuff? But if you only rely on emotion to make decisions about policy, you've got what you want in Raleigh right now.
You've got what you want. Well, I want to thank you. I know you're running and having a convention here. How can people get in touch with you if they want to get in touch with you to find out what's going on? Give us a website, a phone number or something.
Well, the website is being reconfigured right now, but you can still reach me at info@johnautry.net. That's johnautry.net, info@johnautry.net. And I'd be eager to talk to folks to help explained. I'd be happy to come and visit neighborhood meetings to talk about the capital improvement plan, to talk about transit in our city, and to talk about what it's going to take to continue to see that Charlotte becomes a viable, vibrant place that you want to live, that people want to come and live in, raise their families, build their businesses, determine their own futures in the city of Charlotte is the way that we have to be looking at how we're going to move forward.
And, you know, one other question, what are we going to do? Is the city spraying these trees? Because I see these little inchworms now. Come eat, they were all over my car this morning. What are we doing about that?
Well, I would direct you to the city arborist at what the spraying plan is. I know we have money for that, but we also have a campaign to ban these trees.
Right.
I mean, I rode my bicycle over here this morning, and I'm standing in here a couple of minutes, and a friend of mine is pulling the little worms off of my shirt, and I said, "Oh wow!" And I didn't stop anywhere. They must have fallen on me while I was, you know, making my way down the street. But you know, look, Charlotte is a great town. Charlotte's best years are ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would wager that any other city in this country would love to be Charlotte on Charlotte's worst day.
I think so. Thank you, right?
Oh, thank you
very much. Well, it was good. Thank you very much, John Autry, City Council.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Okay, please. Maurice don't want to hear nothing about no. They got the money for it. She wanted to know how come they didn't do it. Because I was out here last Sunday banning these daggone trees in my yard. And I still haven't got all of them because, I mean, it cost me $500 to ban all these trees.
Yeah.
So, but I got the ones close to the deck and down the driveway. But my next door neighbor didn't ban his, so they're inching over the history. And man, that's a complete utter mess. But, hey, what we were talking about during this interview just now, this could be Detroit. This is the state gives us the right to even exist.
Yep.
And they're taking away the daggone $3 to $4 billion that we got every year from the airports. They want to close the CMS and make them all charter schools. They're going to do this to Elizabeth Traditional. Elizabeth Traditional is on the chopping block to become a charter school taken out of the CMS system.
Yeah.
And once the county and the city start losing money, they'll say, "Hey, you guys can't manage your stuff. We're going to send in a manager."
Yeah, they're going to pull that financial manager shenanigans. We've been looking at this for the last couple of years. They set up these master plans. They put in everywhere they go, they put it into action. And they just do these things in order, you know, A, B, C, D. It's the same way with everywhere they go in. They instantly have that legislation. You know, it's like, let's ban same-sex union. Let's do this. Let's do that. They have it all on the table, and it's just ready to be implemented.
We have to worry about that whole,
you know, Wisconsin
model. Well, this is the first time in 125 years that they've had everything in place, from the governor, the House, and the Senate.
Which is why.
It's never been done before. They think they need to do it.
It's not that they need to. They have the shot. They want to take the opportunity because they can ramrod anything through, which they've already been doing. You know, they've been cutting worker benefits and everything else week after week.
The unemployment from 535 to 335?
Mm-hmm. They cut it.
I mean, you can't even go to McDonald's for 335.
No, it's ridiculous. But what we have to do is be vigilant, and the people have to stand up because it's just overreach. It's unnecessary. But you have to pay attention because these things don't happen in a vacuum. And like you said, you know, when they take funding away from this and funding away from that, to knock the legs off of that, and things start toppling and all, and then say, "Oh, there's a disaster. We've got to step in." Yeah, it's manufactured disasters. Okay, and let's pay attention. Otherwise, we're going to end up exactly in the same situation. We're going to have rights, we're going to have no choices, and we're going to have no government.
Well, they took away, in Detroit, Ann Arbor, they took away that whole seaport.
Oh, yeah.
And they made it private.
Yes. That's because...
private!
You remember, you were just talking with him about this, you know, the Thatcher death and all this, and these quotes like, there's no society, there's only profit.
Right.
this is the, you know, capitalist dream, is to privatize all things in society. There is no public good. There's only me, me,
only me.
You know, and if they can take away, just think about it, if they can take away your cities and your schools and your every other right that you have, and your right and everything, and just turn it into a private profit for them, hey, it's all good. You get no voice and they get all the money. What's wrong with that?
We have the rare opportunity to interview the Patricia Cotham, who is the chair of the county commission.
Pat Cotham's awesome.
And I'd like you to hear that right now.
Okay, I'm here with Patricia Cotham, who is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission. And she's also in a lot of other things. And tell us.
I'm also a DNC member. There's seven of us elected in the state. I'm one of them. And I'm also chair of the Uptown Democratic Forum for the last 13 years.
What are some of your... I know this is really your first time, your foray into actual politics, although you've been a politician forever. What have you seen the difference between the grassroots end of it and the actual foray into politics?
You know, it is. I've always been in the background. I've always helped a lot of candidates get elected. So I've always been that person. And it is different to be the candidate. So, it was an adjustment. It was an adjustment. But I really felt all the experience I had in helping other candidates, was very helpful. And I feel like I know the values of the people. And I've talked to a lot of people over the many years, and I talked to many people on the campaign trail. So I felt like I had a good pulse on what was on the minds and hearts of people as I went in and then eventually got elected.
Well, you see, you knew what was on the hearts of the people, the everyday people out here, but not what's in the minds and hearts of the people on the county commission. Now, that's a different entity.
Right. And that's true. And it's one of my colleagues said it's kind of like we're on a bus ride. And, we're on a bus, and there's nine of us on the bus, and we're on the bus together for 2 years. And so, you do have to, work to build relationships with other people. And, people have their own agendas. And, the Democrats are in the majority, but there are still differences among us. So, we've only been there a few months, and I'm trying to work hard to, build relationships. And I have tried and I've been successful at building relationships with the Republicans, which is important because their team is in charge in Raleigh, and I need to have good relationships with them and also with Raleigh, in the leadership in Raleigh, because we get a lot of our money from Raleigh. So, you catch more bees with honey than you do vinegar. So we do have a lot of common ground. A lot of the issues we work on are not Democratic issues or Republican issues. They're, they're community issues. So, we work together, and, so far we're doing well. When we came on the board, we had a lot of serious problems with the county. The revaluation affected 45,000 people negatively, and we're trying very hard to get that fixed. But the county failed at that, and they also, it was very important to try to rebuild trust with people because so many people had lost trust. So I've really kept that as a real focus also, and try to be very transparent, very available. Anytime a reporter calls me, I talk to them. Sometimes I regret it later, but I do talk to them because, they're the vehicle to the people, and I want the people to know what's going on. And I've asked a lot of questions, and the staff people do not like it, but it's what the people want. So that's what's happening, and so I'm doing that, and I'm not going to stop.
Well, do you find, especially from your grassroots roots, the people do not know what the county commission does?
A lot of people don't, and that's okay. I mean, people have a lot to go on, so I always try to talk about who we are and what we do, the main services that we have, like we fund the schools, Central Piedmont, the libraries, mental health, Department of Social Services, the Parks and Recreation Department. I always say we're not the police. We don't do the police or the firemen. We don't do the streets. We don't fix potholes. That's the city. So the city has, you know, they have their own things, and then the county has different things. But we deal more with the services. And that was why I ran, because I had worked with people of poverty for several years, people coming out of prison. And they had people who are poor have the most to gain or lose by who's on the county commission, but they don't even know it because they're living in crisis and in chaos often. So I wanted them to have a voice. So, you know, I often, when I go places and I meet people, like when I met the head of the Center City Partners, and he was telling me all that they did for the city, and I said, well, what are you doing for poor people? And I asked the chamber that, too. What are you doing for poor people? So, you know, I always try to bring that up, and, you know, because that's why I ran for office.
Well, you know, does it ever seem like the old Abbott and Costello routine of who's on first, what's on second, Arizona's on third base?
Yes, a lot of times it's kind of crazy. But, you know, when it is gets crazy, you just laugh and you do the best you can and you move forward. You know, I don't get flustered. I just keep going forward because I'm very focused. I'm very focused on improving things. There's a lot of problems at the county, and there's a lot of that needs to be much more transparent. People need to know what's going on with their tax dollars. Just as you and I are talking right now, I see people walking down the street. They are the people who are paying the bills, and they need to know what's going on with their money. And so that's my goal, to make sure it's more transparent. I know, remember when I first started, it was before Christmas holiday, and there was a Christmas tree on the floor at the office at the government center. And the next day, seven enormous, I'm not talking like Harris Teeter, I'm talking like a big florist, seven enormous poinsettias showed up under the tree. And the first thing I said is, who's paying for this? Please don't tell me the taxpayers. And I looked down the hall and I saw these enormous poinsettias. And I'm like, who's paying for all this? And where did they go? I said, do we give them to crisis assistance? Do we take them to the Salvation Army? Do we take them to the senior center? What do we do with them? And the response was, oh, no, the senior staff, they take them home. And I'm thinking of poor people who don't have a Christmas tree, who don't have any money, who don't have any gifts for their children. Yet there's a waste of poinsettias under a Christmas tree. It just set me off. And
and the county is paying for it.
In the county, the taxpayers are paying for that.
Well, you know,
the taxpayers are paying. I didn't like it.
Well, you know, I was talking to my priest father, Carl, earlier at Constellation, and he said that the former Pope Benedict got a listing when he first got there that during the Christmas vacation, during the Christmas holiday, the nativity scene was put out every year, and it costs $750,000 to put it out every year. Now, this is something that's in storage. Who is paying for this, and who is getting paid to put it out? It's the same information, the same statues, the same everything every year, and it costs $750,000. So this is a problem.
That sounds like a real problem. That sounds like a and I'm Catholic, so that's a real problem for me.
So,
but you know. There has to be, I mean, these are difficult times.
Right.
Families are struggling. Even, you know, not just poor people, but even
right.
people who are well-to-do or middle-income or affluent, they're struggling too. A lot of them are struggling. Maybe not as much as the poor person, but they still, you know, they're still struggling. People are watching what they're spending, and the county needs to do the same thing. And the city does too, I'm sure, and the state. But, you know, we need to be, but I just want to cut the waste so that there's enough money for our schools, for our seniors, for our young people, and adults who are trying to get more education for Central Piedmont. Mental health is very important, and that affects so many families. We need to focus more on that. So, I mean, I want to cut the waste so that we have the money that we need for the services that are important to Mecklenburg County.
Well, the regressive Republican people in the House, I had Larry Hall on my show, Democratic leader, this past Friday, and he said, Edgar Starn said, we were elected, we don't care what you think, we're not going to do anything about it, and we're not going to apologize. So how does that affect the people in this entire state when they're going to do what they want to do?
Well, you know, let's just, I think we need to play the devil's advocate. I mean, the Democrats did that too. You know, I mean, really, you know, Democrats did that too. And, you know, the Republicans are better at being a minority party. When they're, like, look in Washington, when they were the minority party, they were like bulldogs. Whereas, you know, when we were the minority party, we're just all real nice.
Yeah, but they're bulldogs now.
Yeah, well, they are.
In the
they
minority
are.
Party.
And so what I'm saying is we need to learn from that. When they were in the minority, they were bulldogs. And we need to be bulldogs.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be out there asking the tough questions. And so, you know, that's something that's just our party, you know, we're the ones who are always trying to help people. We're the ones, you know, trying to give a helping hand to a family. But you know, we need to be more focused on our issues, and we need to speak out more. And, you know, things happen for a reason. And, you know, if that one, just because that one Republican said that, I don't think that all the Republicans think that. I think many of them do. I think many of them do, and I think a lot of the results that are coming out there show that. But, you know, but also, you know, how will that work for them? You know, that may not work for them as time goes on. So the main thing is we can't change who they are. They're going to do what they're going to do. They haven't been in power in 100 years. So, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. But what we have to do is to keep our issues out there, and we have to try to build relationships with them and explain to them, you know, what this is all about, and get our people, you know, to be out there. You know, so that's something that we have to do, but we have to kind of play the hand we're dealt. And I don't think it helps if we call them names. I think it just helps if we give really good information and try to get them to see a different way. And I think there are some, and I have seen some that will do that. And I have talked to, I mean, I have Republican legislators who call me because they've been trying to help the county, and they call me, and I'm always very, you know, appreciative and thankful that they do, because they don't have to do that. And I, you know, frankly, I don't know if the past speaker, the Democratic speaker, if he ever did that. Maybe he did. If he reached out to Republicans, I don't know. But the main thing is we are where we are, and we've got to do our best to stay focused and to move forward on the issues that are important to us.
Well, I want to thank you. Before we go, how's the grandson?
Oh, yes. My little Elliot is just, he's wonderful. And my daughter, Representative Trisha Cotham, is expecting again in September. We do not know if it's a boy or a girl, but we do know it's a Democrat. So I do know that, but I don't know if it's a
Democrat. Well, our father and mother is a Democrat, and our grandmother is a Democrat, and our grandfather is a Democrat. They're all Democrats.
That's right. So we have another Democrat coming
up. Okay, I want to thank you very much for this time. And we're going to come back to this because, you know, it's only been the start. You've only been here the start. You, but, you know, it seems like up there in Raleigh, they'd only been in office 6 weeks. It seems like 6 years.
I know, because they were focused.
That's right. They were
you
focused.
You've got to give them credit.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to give them credit.
Yeah.
They were focused.
Yeah.
They had a plan, and they planned the work, and they worked the plan. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, and the people, but are the people liking the plan? Well, you know, the voters will have to make up their mind on that.
Right. Okay, I want to thank you very much for this time, and I'm going to ask you to come back.
All right, again.
Thank
I'm Pat Cotham, Chair of the County Commission, and thank you for your time, Michael.
Okay, Pat Cotham,
right.
And I want to tell you that there is a lot of things going on, a lot of things that are problematic with of what we can do here.
Right.
But she's new also to the county commission, so we're going to make sure we give her all the help that we have, and we're going to back her up. We're going to have her on again. And
but you know, she pointed that out, though,
yeah.
That it's a plan. They have
plans. Of course,
they have plans. We need to start paying attention.
We need to start paying attention. And right now, I have someone on the phone right here. Who's calling? Who's it? Hello? Hello? You're on the air. Who's this?
Apparently
no one? Okay. Good.
Well, they stepped away for a second.
They stepped away for a minute. Well, then you just
second.
Hang on. We'll come back to you. We have a one more segment. Yes.
Michael Lawson again at the county convention for the Democratic Party in Mecklenburg County, and I am with
City Councilman David Howard.
David Howard and City Councilman, what does your district cover?
I am actually at large, brother, so the whole city is my district.
So the city is your apple. Now, there are a lot of things I can ask you, but one of the main things is, how are we going to handle this regressive party that's in Raleigh?
I think what we need to do is actually sometimes when things are this crazy, you need to get out the way and let people start to feed on themselves. From what I understand, they're actually not getting along up there. And, I mean, that's actually what happens when one party has that much power and they got all these added laws and they're trying to do, you know, not good governance, but social engineering. So, I mean, you know, that's what I think they got going on. We just need to move out their way and let them feed on themselves.
Well, you know, we supposedly had a moderate Republican governor here for 85 years, and now he's up in Raleigh. He don't seem too moderate.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of times you have to appeal to the far-right part of your party. And in order to get elected the governor, he had to appeal to the far-right part of his party. And now he owes him. I mean, you know, I think that pragmatic pad is still there, but, you know, he's got some folks to pay back.
Well, you know, yeah, but you're right about that, but I don't think this is the first time, I guess it's 100, 125 years that the legislature and the governorship was in the hands of the Republican Party. Now, we did not vote in 2010. That's why these people are in. So, I, you know, him appealing to one side or the other, I don't know that's really an issue.
Well, I'm not, he got a lot of support in the urban areas, and that is our vote. I think there were some people that thought, you know, hey, we know this guy, at least in Charlotte, and we thought that would mean something for us. And I think we found out it doesn't mean a thing. So, I mean, you know, hopefully what we did is learn the lesson going into the elections next year. I mean, you know, what we need to do is just put pictures of all those guys in Raleigh on a postcard and say, you want this again?
Well,
you know, they've been in office for 6 weeks. That's all it's been. It's been 6 weeks, and we have heard more turmoil out of Raleigh than we've heard in, I guess, the last 100 years.
Well, I had Larry Hall, the Democratic leader, on my show this past Friday. What Larry is saying, it is a zoo and a horror zoo up there. They have this guy, Edgar Starnes, I think his name is, who said, we got elected. We don't care what you say. We don't care. We're not going to do nothing about it. And we are not going to apologize.
Well, the great thing about that, though, is that usually when you have that attitude and you don't care about the people, you're not up there alone. So, I mean, you know, hopefully they don't do anything we can't reverse in another year and a half.
Well, the thing is that they redistricted, and that's going to be 10 years. 10 years!
I don't know, because when they won before the districts had changed. And they won because Democrats were asleep on the job. Those were our districts they won in the first time. So just like they won, it's all about turnout. We can win in their districts, too, if we turn out. Now, they're messing with us with voter ID, and they're trying to suppress and everything else. But that just means we got to step up. What we can't do is step back while they do this stuff.
Now, the former mayor, which name should not be mentioned, who's now governor,
Governor McCord.
He said he was the one who started the transit here with the streetcars, and now he wants to dump that?
I don't know if it's dumped. Just to be fair to him, what he's saying is that the financing that they put in place while he was mayor, he promised to the public that that's what they would use. But the problem is that that's not fundable anymore. That money's not coming in anymore. So what we got to do is figure out how to keep that system going. I mean, I would hope that he's committed no matter what it takes. And I'm not sure he showed that he's committed to no matter what it takes yet.
Well, that you know, what you're saying, I hope it's true, but he was the mayor here, and now he wants to take the airport.
I think what he's doing is being quiet, which is the same thing as being complicit to me. So, I mean, you know, I think we need somebody in Raleigh to step up. I keep waiting for the citizens of Charlotte to step up. I mean, you know, because what these people are doing is they're talking about taking an investment that the citizens of Charlotte made to make our city world class, and they're just going to take it from us. And they're not just doing it to us. They're doing it to cities across North Carolina. In Asheville, they did the airport last year. They're talking about taking Asheville's water system. They're taking land back from Raleigh that they gave them. They're messing with Greensboro. I mean, you know, this is an attack on urban areas. It's not just Charlotte.
Well, they want to take this school that we're in right now. They want to make it a state, a county school instead of a city school.
I don't know about that one, but, you know, they know that we're meeting here today, so I guess they're trying to stop us from meeting in this shit.
What is your top three agenda items that you see you need to do in this term?
I'm still working on my platform, but I can tell you I've spent a lot of time over the last 3 years working to keep our mass transit system going. The idea that the sales tax won't continue to pay for what we needed to pay for shouldn't stop us from moving this community forward, and putting that kind of infrastructure in place is extremely important. I would think the next thing would be the creation of jobs, and I don't think it's just the incentives of bringing big companies here. We got to continue to find ways to incentivize small businesses to grow, to make sure that those future industries that are moving America forward are here and welcome here. We have a niche with the energy sector with Duke Energy here. We need to continue to move that forward. And then I think the last thing for me, Michael, would be to make sure that we're continuing to protect our quality of life. Things like the Panthers and other things like our parks and you know, being walkable. I mean, all those things that make people want to live here, the things we need to make sure we're a part of moving forward.
Well, you know, also I know you're a part of the Charlotte City Partners. And how is, and my church is, you've been doing a lot over with my church, Our Lady Constellation. How is that partnership
nice?
Working?
Isn't that looking nice?
Looking fabulous.
That's actually my project. What you're talking about is for a living. I work for the Charlotte Mecklenburg Housing Partnership. And
for a living. That's
for
how
a
you
living.
Put it, right?
Oh, yeah. Because the city council, by the way, doesn't pay it for it. No, it doesn't. Let's be clear. I'm saying that again. It's not a living. I work 40 hours for doing it, but, you know, it's a part-time job, supposedly. But the housing partnership, we're doing good things. I mean, that's a whole neighborhood, about 100 acres, a mile from downtown that we're turning around. So when I grow up, I want to be like Anthony Fox. That's why I want to be.
Anthony Fox? Who's he? I know him, but somewhere.
The corpse with the veto. That's what he is.
He's since I have you both here, you know,
I didn't do it. I'm telling you right now.
The mayor's denying it. The Charlotte City Partners has done a great job over the housing partnership has done a great job over where my church is, a Lady Constellation. How is that? How do you think that's going to affect the city of Charlotte as a whole?
The development. Well, it shows that you can revitalize an area without. Without completely gentrifying it. I mean, in terms of people having to be moved out, this is a way of bringing together a mixture of incomes, but in a setting that allows folks who are at the margins to raise their aspirations and to live in a community that's sustainable over the long term. The problem with an area like Double Oaks was that the conditions became so bad that it was barely housing. Now we have complete housing and a complete community, and that's really what we want our whole city to be like.
Well, you know, but the thing I was just speaking to David here about the Regressive Party up in Raleigh. I had a long talk with Democratic Leader Hall yesterday on my show, and he told us that what's going on up there, people will not believe.
Yeah.
And you know, it seems like it's been 6 years. So much stuff is going on. The airport is a main issue. Can this happen? Take over?
Oh, absolutely, it can happen.
Well, it's not like we're gonna just sit and let them do it.
Well, but you see, but look, you can look at Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, what did the governor do in Detroit? I mean, you know, when you have a how you doing, darling? He said, "Well, when you have a problem, just like Detroit, where you didn't have a city council and a county commission that was won, these people up in Raleigh think that they can just come in. Hey, suppose they say, well, I want the mayor out. We're going to declare that they can't take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to take away a tax base, starting with the airport. What do we do?
It's a shame. I've never seen anything like it, but, you know.
And this is from the mayor who used to be here for 100 years.
Yeah. Well, what I can tell you is that the city council is committed to doing everything we can. We're doing a study now, and we're gonna figure it out. I mean, what we're going to do is we're not going to just kind of turn around and say it's okay. We're going to do all that we can to fight and educate people about why it's not a good idea.
Okay, well, I want to thank you Just tell us, how can they get rid of you? I mean, how can they get? How can they get you to see everything or speak to you? What's a good way? It's email and phone number.
The city council website has all the information, but my email is info@davidhowardclt.com. Welcome to call me anytime.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, David, that was the. We don't want to get rid of you, David.
Yeah.
We need you here.
But another good interview. You know, these guys are pointing out things that are happening all over the place.
Right.
But the problem with the average citizen is they don't pay attention to the detail. And
I don't have time. I'm coming home. I'm tired. I got the kids. I want to feed them. I want to eat something myself, and I want to lay down, and I want to go to sleep.
But if you don't pay attention, you lose everything. I mean, these people, the scary part here, what they're talking about, they're talking about concerted efforts across the entire state. Republicans are taking over municipalities. They're taking over individual businesses and or services like airports, water, you know, transportation. These are very dangerous, very important things that are occurring, and people have got to pay attention. And don't think that it's just you or it's just happening at one spot. What we were just talking about in these interviews is happening all over the state. And everybody thinks, oh, maybe it's just happening right there. Maybe it's an isolated incident. This isn't isolated. If you broaden your view, it's not just North Carolina. North Carolina is the latest state to be victimized. But this is an ongoing plan. It's part of the privatization of America that our good friends, as I said, Dick and Dick, Dick Armey, Dick Cheney, have been propagating for years. You know, they're I call them like the architects of this, but, you know, you remember Dick Armey. He used to be the privatization master. And he loved this stuff. These are the people behind movements. Like, you remember Dick Armey is one of the founders of the Tea Party. But people forget, you know.
Here. But anyway, we'll move on. But we got to be talking about Jackie Robinson's story. We're going to have Big George on. Now, listen, how about I had Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center on about 2 weeks ago. And when or 3 weeks ago, when these killings occurred with the DA and his wife, and then the assistant DA about 2 months before that,
because
it was a big
thing. Yeah, but on the news, it had the appearance of the guy that they originally called, you remember, looked like a skinhead, and it looked like it was maybe some kind of Aryan Nation type deal.
But who was pushing that? That wasn't the law enforcement. That was Fox News. That was all these ultraviolet. I mean, even Mark Potok said, we don't know. We've got to be careful.
Right.
Mark said that. We don't know. We have to be careful or who this is. We don't know. Even though the increase from when Barack Obama came into office was 136 of these outrageous groups to now over 1,300, we still have to be careful because we do not know. And now we come to find out. The authorities say the wife of former judge has confessed to being involved in a shooting death of the Northwestern district attorney and his wife and the assistant district attorney. Kim Lean Williams was arrested early Wednesday, and you should see what she looks like. She looked like a thug. She was arrested Wednesday early in Coffman County. Sheriff's spokesman said Justin Lewis says Williams is being charged in all three deaths. Lewis says she is being held on $10 million bond.
Right.
According to the arrest warrant affidavit, Williams told investigators Tuesday that she was involved in the shootings of Coffman County District Attorney Mike
McLeland and his wife, Cynthia, and one of the prosecutors, Mark Hatt. The investigation is also focused on her husband, Eric Williams, whom McLeland and Hatt successfully prosecuted for theft. McLeland's were found dead on March 30th, 2 months after Hatt was slain. And this guy that she's talking about, who the Eric Williams, who was successfully prosecuted by McLean in the House, is a sheriff in one of them little podunk towns down there in Texas somewhere. So everybody was looking for a skinhead, and it was why, and the reason why, because he was a sheriff in the town, and he was stealing computer equipment. So he lost his job, and he was probably going to go to jail. I don't know what the...
She was mad that he got caught.
She was mad, and it happened to be prosecuted by her ex-husband. I mean, give us a... You know, down there in Texas, they're completely lunatic. They're lunatic.
In one of these crazy movie of the week type.
Yeah. I mean, please, give me a break. Yeah. Also...
But you know what?
Yeah.
I thought this might be a good point to say, Texas just shot full of news this week.
Yeah, how about that?
I mean, it is bam.
Bam. Hey, worst ever U.S. industrial accident since 1947. 576 people died in 1947 in a similar explosion of tons of ammonium nitrate and...
Fertilizer. But funny thing is, not only is it a exact same substance explosion, and the, you know, same result, you know, gee, who could have thought? You know?
Who would have thought?
But it's also in Texas.
Look,
the two worst industrial accidents in the entire history of this nation have been in Texas. They were the same unregulated industry.
The clown governor in Texas had the nerve to get on TV the other day. Oh, this is terrible. Yeah, he killed all regulation governing how industry would be checked out in Texas.
That's
killed
it. No oversight. Did you see that timeline that they did on, was it either Maddow or somebody the other night on this disaster? It went back through like the last 10 years. They have 6 inspectors for the entire state or something.
Since 1965, they have not had an inspector.
Yeah.
Well, 1985.
And at that time, they said they got fined.
Right.
For being so willfully ignoring all laws and violating things.
Right.
You know what the fine was? $2,000.
Right.
And then they didn't even follow up.
It was $5,250, and it was knocked down to 20-something.
Yeah, because that would be an infringement of their corporate rights.
Oh.
We can't hurt their profits.
The Associated Press showed that U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration fined West Fertilizer, this is the latest one, $10,000 last summer, for safety violations, including planning to transport hazardous ammonia without a security plan.
Right.
An inspector also found the plant's ammonia tanks weren't properly labeled.
Right.
In a risk management plan filed with the Environmental Protection Agency about a year earlier, the company said it was not handling flammable material and did not have sprinklers, water deluge systems, blast walls, firewalls, or other safety mechanisms in place at the plant because it wasn't needed.
Yeah, it wasn't needed. Yeah, is that why there's only rubble across the street where that school used to be?
There is? Oh, okay. State officials require all facilities that handle hazardous ammonia to have sprinklers and other safety measures because of this flammable substance, according to Mike Wilson, permitting for the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality. He's the only one that works for that. He has no employees. he's the only one. I said, but inspectors would not necessarily check for such mechanisms, and it's not known whether they did when West Plant was last inspected in 2006, said Garcia, head of the enforcement in Plant. Okay, head of enforcement appliance in Texas. He's the only one who works for that department also.
Yeah.
So the thing is...
Well, the thing is, you get what you invest in.
Absolutely.
So when you do away with inspections, you do away with safety regulations, you do away with any accountability for companies to protect the public, guess what you get?
Oh, yeah, but what did Thatcher say? What was that she said, Thatcher?
Oh, well, it's only about profit.
It's only about profit.
Yep.
Forget the people who are going to be blown up or are going to die. Forget about them.
Well, I mean, they've already
make the money.
Gotten, like, what, 12 bodies out or whatever and all this. I'm of that mind, just like with the gun battle we've been having lately over whether or not we should have sensible, you know, licensing and background checks. If you can protect one person, it's worth doing.
But this is
absolutely ridiculous. No, but we just blew half of a town off the map in Texas because we can't bog down a company's day-to-day raking in of the profits enough to have simple safety precautions that we know work.
You're working in a hazardous. That's
you know as you're working with an explosive thing.
Right.
You know this is something that's used the world over bombs. You know
it was used during
World War II.
That's the point.
One.
You know you're working with dangerous materials, but that's the job you have chosen. As Hyman Roth said,
right
in The Godfather, this is the job we have chosen.
Well, you know, I guess you can just throw those miners down in the bottom of the mine and say, hey, having trouble breathing and choking on the dust?
Too bad.
That's your problem. Buy your own filter.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is the job you have chosen.
You're on your own.
I
welcome
mean,
to the new America. And
by the way,
I have this further problem with Texas. Why did they build or allow to be built a school in an apartment complex across the parking lot from a massive fertilizer factory? I mean, this is on its face so stupid. It was something like, you know.
They just kill half the workers that will be working here in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I know. You talk about, you know, impact your profits. They want your whole workforce. But why do that? Why not put it on the outskirts of town? Put it in the middle. Hey, you know what? I've heard there's a lot of desert out there. Why not put it out there?
You
know,
right?
Make somebody drive 30 miles to get to it instead of parking a school in its parking lot. You know what I mean? Just, oh, my gosh.
Well.
I don't know, Mike.
Now we also get to our favorite subject of the week.
What's that?
One of our favorite subjects of the week. Just,
well, I have so many.
I know. Just
the yeas are 54, the nays are 46. Under the previous order requiring 60 votes for the adoption of this amendment, the amendment is not agreed to. The order in the Senate.
The grim irony of the past few days is that as cable news was going into 24-hour wall-to-wall coverage, and the country's attention was drawn to the latest mass casualty event, away from the cameras on Capitol Hill, Republican senators were quietly filibustering, and with that vote, killed the last meaningful piece of legislation to address the last mass casualty event.
Now,
that's a true irony, right?
I mean, it's just, I don't know. I don't know what to say. These people said they would not filibuster. They would not filibuster. And yet they filibustered.
Of course. Because they're, like she said, cowards.
Now, let's hear. I mean, I have not seen the President of the United States upset. He was upset when this went down.
The gun lobby and its allies willfully lied about the bill. And unfortunately, this pattern of spreading untruths about this legislation served a purpose. Because those lies upset an intense minority of gun owners. And that, in turn, intimidated a lot of senators. I've heard some say that blocking this step would be a victory. And my question is, a victory for who? A victory for what? Victory for not doing something that 90% of Americans, 80% of Republicans, the vast majority of your constituents wanted to get done? It begs the question, who are we here to represent? So all in all, this was a pretty shameful day for Washington.
Pretty shameful day for Washington, but here's the bottom line.
How many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome? Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And I said to myself, this is the business we've chosen.
To screw the American public, because the American public as a whole are idiots. If they weren't idiots, we would not be in the position we are right now, pointing fingers at everybody, saying there's a boogeyman behind every tree, there's black helicopters in the sky, they want to come and take your guns away. The public are morons, because they listen to these fools that are out there. You know, I shouldn't say the fools. The public are the fools. Because they listen to these people who are prevaricators of selling garbage. They listen to these liars that are only in it for themselves. And because they feed on the fear of everybody that they can. Everybody's not susceptible to fear. Everybody's not that scared of their shadow. Everybody is not scared to walk down the street because there's someone of a different ethnicity walking behind them or beside them.
And you never know.
There are people.
They might be carrying some of the Skittles.
They could be carrying Skittles and wearing a hoodie.
Yeah. That's always an indicator.
They could be dressed up like a normal college student with a white hat on backwards from Chechnya with a...
Would that be a Caucasian thing?
Oh, yes.
As in a caucus, as in a... Eurasian, as in, you know what? That gets to this whole label thing.
Carrying a pressure cooker on their back.
Yeah, and you know what's more white America than a crock pot? I'm just saying, like, come on. There's so many these problems with labels. You know, it's the same reason that like when they did the Bible recently, they had Satan. As a black guy in a hoodie that looked just like Obama. I mean, you know, come on, please, God. Why do we have to go down these roads? But it's the...
Why not? It's easier. It's easier to say someone else is at fault than you're at fault.
Well, you know, and it does get into this entire, the horror of why we shoot Trayvon, you know, on every corner. It's bad to begin with. It's stupid, and it also actually hinders things because we were talking about this earlier. You know, now I'm gonna get to Eric Rush because I think he superseded the others. But you were talking about with CNN and stuff reporting at first that someone in a hoodie and it might be a black guy because obviously only black guys wear hoodies. And, you know, this whole thing. But see, that confuses and hinders the investigation. Because what did it turn out to be? You know, completely the opposite. Guys in, you know, white hats that were white, you know. So, I mean, literally the opposite.
And we got to talk about that, too, because that's a major, major issue. Major issue.
Well, it goes to this, and gets back to Jackie Robinson and everything else. Because some people can't see your talent, can't see your use, can't see your worth. All they see is your skin color, and that's the end of that.
Well, they had
cheap labels.
And getting to your point, what was said over the last, I guess, 4 days or so, Jonathan Miller, who's a CBS correspondent, who used to be the assistant director of the FBI,
mm-hmm.
he was on CBS Morning, and this is what he had to say.
Seen a couple of pictures on the internet in the paper today. Until we see a picture from the authorities, should we discount the pictures that are floating around all over the place?
Those are not the pictures that are going to be released today by the authorities.
Okay.
And in fact,
just wondering that.
Here's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Those pictures were on the internet yesterday morning, and then they started going viral on different sites, and then different intelligence fusion centers around the country pick those up, and they post them into bulletins and say, any law enforcement agencies who can name these people will take that information. Then it ends up leaking back to the newspaper, so it comes out in one big circle.
So the pictures start on the internet, then law enforcement officials start passing them around internally, then they leak back out into the media. And the next thing you know, a 17-year-old who runs track at his high school has made his way from websites like Reddit and 4chan to a viral internet presence into law enforcement chatter and onto the cover of the New York Post. And to be clear, the impossibly poor judgment of the editors of the New York Post was not the only reason this kid's picture was out in the world and being associated with the bombing. In fact, when I saw the front page of the Post this morning, it was actually not the first time I'd seen this particular picture. And the reason I'd seen the picture before was because the other night, I fell down a rabbit hole at my laptop at 11 o'clock at night, browsing a Reddit subthread and a 4chan page in which internet users had come together to do the vigilante work of sifting through all the publicly available images from the marathon. The consequences of this internet sleuthing bad journalism feedback system are not lost on the FBI as they try to find the actual perpetrators. The FBI's special agent in charge made a point to address the issue at tonight's news conference as soon as he'd released the official photos.
For clarity, these images should be the only ones, and I emphasize the only ones, that the public should view to assist us. Other photos should not be deemed credible, and they unnecessarily divert the public's attention in the wrong direction and create undue work for vital law enforcement resources.
Again, let's bring in Adrian Chen, senior writer for Gawker, who writes a lot about Reddit. And I just want to give people a sense of what Reddit is. Now, if
Reddit,
you had the misfortune of watching those developments that I
Reddit is, for the people who don't know out there, is a blog, internet blog, right? That does research on anything.
Yeah, and they also just, you know, they'll go through and gather
right.
things and everybody,
yeah.
you know, all these posts and all this stuff. Because you know how these things go. They're going right. here, there, and yon, and everybody's adding to it.
The thing is, so wait a minute. They're talking about the government doing this?
Well, maybe the government is the one that's really Reddit.
Hey, you never know. They did actually invent the internet, didn't they?
That's right.
You never know how far these things go, speaking of your black helicopters.
And now, wait a minute here. You see?
And see, that's how it just goes back. We have just created the next meme that'll be on. You know, it'll be some black helicopter, you know, Reddit connection, and it'll start circulating.
Well,
you'll see it come back to you tonight.
Oh, absolutely.
Somebody else.
Now, here's the thing now. So are we actually saying that persons of interest is actually going on? We now have civilians that are doing the same thing as the persons of interest and that big site. Where's that site at that the government just listening site? Is it Oklahoma, Colorado? Where's that place at? Utah?
But everywhere?
But they have a site. It's the biggest building in the entire, bigger than the Pentagon?
Yeah.
It's underground?
Yeah,
and all they do?
Echelon.
Is that name?
No, I didn't say that.
They have every...
I'm sorry, somebody just picked up on that.
Every bit of information that goes across your earpiece, that goes across the internet, that goes across anywhere that's in the air, they can grab it out of the air and they archive it.
Yep.
So, but isn't Reddit doing the same thing? So now, let me ask a question now. Is Reddit really the second phase of what the government is doing?
Well, you know.
We can come out and say, we're out there helping you, but Reddit's gathered, getting back to the storyline here, what Chris Hayes was talking about is that on the front page of the Post, they had two guys with backpacks. One had a white hat on, and they plastered their pictures all over the front page that says, "Bagman." These were the two people that planted the bomb. And it wasn't.
Right.
And one of the guys had to stop his Facebook page and his own internet site, and he went and his Facebook page and his Twitter site, and he ran to the police and said, "Look, I am not the person."
Right.
And they said, "No, you're not the person." He said, "Why does the Post have you on here?"
Which
we
didn't
have anything to do with that.
Which will lead to the third phase, the lawsuit that he launches against People for a Public Defense.
Well, you can't touch a lawsuit against a non-entity.
Yeah, it's just something that occurred virally.
Yes, occurred virally.
Well,
Reddit, when they start looking up who's in charge of Reddit, no one. It's a organically grown organism that's out there that does this by itself without any government assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But listen. Here's and this is touching on. Let's jump over here to this Eric Crush post.
Oh,
get back into this because the point of all this is that it has real world consequences. Your words and actions too. When they're putting pictures of people who didn't do anything on the front of newspapers saying "terror bomber of the United States," you know, guess what? It's going to affect that guy's life, right? And likewise,
he had to stop his Facebook page.
He probably had to stop a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, he's fixing to get, you know, killed. So this goes back to the bombing when it first started, though. But this is there's a couple things we'll talk about. We'll get into the Trayvoning of the imagery in just a second. But before that, I want to mention this because Fox News, yet again, our favorite source of real news. This guy, Eric Rush, is one of their, you know, commentators, one of their contributors. And, you know, sadly to say, he's an African-American gentleman, but it's
stupid.
So when this first happened, he came out with this post. This was his original post.
Right.
"Everybody do the national security ankle grab. Let's bring more Saudis in without screening them. Come on." To which Bill Schmalfeld, a guy that does Blood on the Mic, he's on Twitter, he came back and said, "Sweet God, are you already blaming Muslims? They haven't even washed the sidewalks off. You know, this is right when it happens."
Right.
To which Eric, the bigot Rush, says, and I quote, this is Eric's words, "Yes, they're evil. Let's kill them all." Now, in his defense, after that went out and nuked his career, I hope.
Yes.
He followed up. No. That remark was sarcasm, idiot.
Sarcasm, idiot.
Did you catch the sarcasm? Let me read it again. Yeah, they're evil. Let's kill them all.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So funny, Michael.
Well, they must be laughing.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yuck,
and
yuck.
So then he went on to defend himself by saying this. Anybody that attacked him or took issue with what he said they're, quote, foul-mouthed Islamist apologists.
Uh-huh.
And to another one, he said, "You're an Islamist apologist sphincter."
That's even better.
No, yeah, I like that. Woo, you go for it, dude. Now, that's his apologies. Okay. But he's since deleted his post. You know, that makes it go away. Nothing gets on the internet forever. But again.
Oh, right, yeah.
Again,
I got
a
copy.
Yeah, we have this instant reaction. If someone blows something up, he's a Islamo-fascist terrorist guy. You know,
right.
He's Al Qaeda. All Muslims are evil.
I think
he's kill them all. Unlike the Olympic bomber, you know. Unlike the
Eric Rudolph.
Yeah. Remember that nice hunting trip in the Appalachians? Tim McVeigh. Yeah, there's the face of Islamic terrorism, right?
Absolutely.
You know, he's like All American, Captain America, and Soldier Boy. I mean, come on.
Now we got two brothers who couldn't be any whiter unless they lived in freaking Gnome, not even Gnome, the Arctic Circle, whiter than polar bears, and yet.
And look, these are.
I ain't heard nothing about that yet.
These are the, like, you know, Islamic poster boys here.
Yeah, I mean, come on, give me a break. These guys are, as my, I told you, my Facebook friend pointed out. She says, these people, they're literally, okay, if you haven't heard yet, here, let's explain it real quick. These guys are from Chechnya. It's a little bitty province that it was independent from Russia for a brief moment after the Soviet Union fell, but then they took it over. And so they had this horrible separatist war because they're mostly Muslim and they wanted to be independent. Then Russia said, no, we want you to be Russian. You know, so they had this terrible war. You remember, that was Putin's great, glorious war. Okay. Well, anyway, they're refugees with that. Their parents are, anyway.
Right.
They came over here when he's like eight or something. So he's not really, can't really say he's a Chechen. He grew up here, these guys. But they are Chechens, and they grew up there. That, if you don't know your geography, it's in the center of the mountains.
Don't.
Yeah, I know they don't. But it's in the center of all the mountainous region in the middle of Central European Asia, okay, that is called the Caucasus. The Caucasus range of mountains is the source of all of the racial name typing that is applied to the typically what you consider, in our American point of view, the Eurocentric look, right? That's why they called them Caucasian. Okay? So my point is, the lady on Facebook that was a friend of mine pointed, she said, these people are literally Caucasians, literally, from they immigrated from the Caucasus to our country, and yet nowhere in the press, nowhere have you heard the word Caucasian terrorist.
Nope.
Nope. You know, we've already attacked them. This guy, Eric's already attacked them for being Muslims. And then, what was your CNN reporter that everybody's getting mad about?
Versus Caucasian terrorism, let's hear how CNN and Chris Hayes, I have to give him credit, and I'm going to play this whole thing. Chris Hayes went through this, and he ripped CNN and Fox and all these outlets that followed up on this. He takes you to the timeline. Just listen to this.
Now, if you had the misfortune of watching those developments that I just recited play out in real time today, you may well have just lost the thread entirely on the day's events, because this is what it looked like in real time.
This is CNN breaking news.
An arrest has been made. Both France federal source and my Boston source say an arrest has been made.
A federal law enforcement source tells me that an arrest has been made.
A federal source has told her an arrest has been made.
A suspect is about to be arrested. The suspect is to be taken into custody by federal marshals and taken to a courthouse, and that tells us a lot. That tells us they've got him.
One arrest, no understanding really, even though this vague description of brown skin, whether foreign or domestic.
And now it is being told to Fox News, to a Fox News reporter, that indeed an arrest has been made.
According to the AP, the suspect has been taken by U.S. Marshals to a federal courthouse.
Now we are being told by our FoxNews.com reporter that an arrest has been made.
Just to take a half a step back, this has accelerated incredibly quickly.
Some are also reporting that an arrest has been made, and some are reporting that that is not the case. Here's the truth. We don't know.
Julia, we're getting some conflicting reports about an arrest. We have Tom Fuentes with us right now. Tom?
Okay, I have actually three separate sources, but two that are very highly placed and close to the investigation that have just told me that there has been no arrest.
Okay, now, that would be, you know, we don't know what's right or not right at this point, and as Anderson always says, you don't want to go down the road of speculation wrongfully.
No arrests have been made in connection with the Boston Marathon bombings, and that is all we can say for sure.
Let's just take a moment to appreciate the evolution of bad journalism at work here. First, around 1:45 this afternoon, CNN has the big breaking news, arrest made in bombings case. By 2:17 p.m., as the pushback has begun to roll in, they are maybe doubting themselves. It's just breaking news with no further description. Something somewhere is breaking, America. We just can't tell you what it is. Then around 2:30, the breaking news is conflicting reports on bomb arrest. Yes, conflicting because CNN is reporting something that conflicts with what is actually happening in the world. And then finally at 2:43, they relent and report the Justice Department says no arrest has been made. Notice, though, they are still counting that as breaking news. Breaking news, the breaking news we've been bringing you for the past hour is totally and completely bogus. This wasn't just some abstraction happening on cable news that no one was paying attention to. And I understand people make mistakes, but the bungling of this story today mattered.
This is video from outside the... And the one thing people knew about this suspect, the only thing they thought they knew for sure, thanks to CNN's reporting, was the following descriptor.
It was described to me as a dark-skinned male individual.
I was told by one of these sources who was a law enforcement official that this was a dark-skinned male. A source who had been briefed on the investigation, I should say, that the suspect was a dark-skinned male.
Forget about the fact that CNN got wrong the information they said they had. Just explain to me precisely what news value exists in the adjective dark-skinned. What exactly that's newsworthy is communicated in that phrase. A dark-skinned individual could be my swarthier Italian-American relatives or the Ethiopian who won the Boston Marathon before it was bombed on Monday and everyone in between. That's not the purpose of that phrase. That phrase is not there to convey journalistic information. What dark-skinned actually communicates with a wink and a nod is, aha, all you folks who thought it was a bad Muslim who did this, you nailed it. And if you had Al-Qaeda in your own private betting pool, you were right. Because, of course, let's be honest, that is the subtext that suffuses all of this. That is what our collective societal id is pushing us towards. But our job in the media is not to flatter those knee-jerk presumptions for the sake of momentary titillation. It's to wrestle that id to the ground and get the facts right. So, let's go back to what we do know about the investigation at this hour.
So, did Chris Hayes put it correctly or what?
Yeah. And my favorite part about that is not just calling them out on any one point, but pointing out the other thing. It's like, they themselves know, and they said right at that moment, everything we've been reporting is breaking news. So the whole last half hour is
awful. It's awful. And the thing is that John King, who I like a lot, got on there and said, well, my boss just told me, and we're hearing from Fran Townsend, who Fran Townsend is a complete moron because she was a shill for the Bush administration the whole time she was there. She don't know Jack from Shinola. Okay? And this just proves it because I was with Homeland Security, so therefore I know the wind is going to pick it up out there, isn't it? Anyway.
Speaking of the wind picking up. These people have to still
airtime.
And they sit there 24/7 just going, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
What do we do?
It's entertainment, people. It's not news. And that's right. What you've got to, as my brother says, unplug. Now, he's completely unplugged. He can't stand it. And he says, just turn off the noise. Now, we listen to it so we can keep up and analyze it. However, it's important that you are a critical thinker and you don't sit here.
You have to think about what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, why do you have to think about what you're saying?
I don't know. You're the teacher of these courses. Why don't you teach us, Mike?
Is there a reason
we should think about what we hear and see?
Because you might be a fool if you don't.
I think you might be a 24-hour-a-day news cycle apologist sphincter if you don't think for yourself. He will paraphrase a good friend of ours on Fox News.
Yes. You know the old thing about assuming.
Yeah, assume. Exactly.
Right? Assuming.
Let's see. How do you spell that?
This is the whole thing. Assuming.
Yes. So the thing is, people, pay attention. Don't just listen to the sparkly banter coming off the TV and the who has the loudest breaking news, you know, logo and slogan going at the moment, but actually think about what they're saying and what they're trying to get you to swallow, you know, because this is how people get confused, led, and things happen.
Well, see,
and they have, listen, this, you want to talk about real world consequences? Remember before, people were flying planes into buildings, and the next thing we knew, we had a USA Patriot Act, dun, 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 as we were dropping bombs in Baghdad, going after those Islamo-fascists that bombed us in Manhattan.
None of it had a connection. Islamo-fascists just rolled off the tongue.
Oh, I know. I mean, the things they make up, right? So, again, we find out years later that, gasp, there were no connections. None of it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if you don't pay attention, stuff happens. You need to pay attention, folks, because, for instance, one of my news items I was going to point out to you.
Yes.
While all of the breaking news. We've got hoodies in Boston bombing.
What's going on? Or nobody was paying attention?
Yeah.
While the Congress was simultaneously voting down any kind of law to regulate guns, that's evil, right?
Of course.
You may not have noticed, but the House of Representatives passed yet again. CISPA. You remember that little joyful act?
Yeah. Oh, love it.
That would be the, we're not going to monitor guns. Instead, we're going to monitor the Internet and everything
you
do.
Oh, absolutely, because we know.
Because that's where the
if
real...
If it's on the Internet, it's true.
Yeah, that's where the real dangers are.
Just like this girl in the commercial that met the French bottle on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
He looked like Godzilla. Not that Godzilla hit a little better. But anyway, the thing is that we are in a position now where persons of interest become clearer.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, becomes mo real.
Enemy of the state.
Mm-hmm. Hey,
it's true.
It's already here. The good side of it is, at the same time, well, we can decry it. I mean, they you know, echelon your calls and your Internet and your everything else, and it's the black helicopter flying overhead. However, at the same time, using that enemy of the state technology, they're already killed one of the brothers and capturing the other one
on
the run because they had him all on camera and they're monitoring everything he did. They already are talking about what he tweeted and wrote about 3 months ago on the Internet. So they already got all of it.
That's what I'm saying. How come the people aren't complaining about that?
Right.
Oh, because they helped capture somebody that blew up something?
And again,
why you don't complain. Now I get it.
But see, that's the good side of it. However, there is a downside. Because they monitor you like Orwell 24/7.
Now, see, I'm looking at here at the MSNBC, as we're having this show, we're looking at the MSNBC show,
mm-hmm.
and down at the bottom on the crawl, it says breaking news. It's the same breaking news since 2:30 yesterday afternoon.
It's been breaking news since the...
How can it be breaking news? What's breaking about it? It's the same thing. They're showing the same two guys walk through the crowd before they planted the bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it stopping from breaking news and...
It's never not breaking news, Mike. They've had that breaking news logo up there since the puff of smoke, as the people were still running the marathon. I mean, come on.
Well,
it's called
yes.
Breaking the people, breaking attention span.
Is that almost like making you? But you know, it's almost like the little boy that cried wolf.
Mm. Well, you remember.
As I tell my daughter all the time. Samantha, you keep crying wolf, no one's going to believe you until the blood comes under the door, and when the blood comes over the door, it's too late. The wolf has already eaten you. You know, so we keep saying breaking news. There's nothing breaking about this news. Thousands of police searched for one man. Mm-hmm. What is breaking news about that when that's been up there since 2000? You know, here I was going to get to bed early last night.
Which in and of itself is ludicrous. Because
right. But I was going to get to bed.
You were actually going to get ready.
I was going to get to sleep 1:30. I said, I am finished. I'm going to
sleep.
And I said, you know, let me check one thing. I said, no, let me set up the equipment tonight so I don't have to do it tomorrow. So I said, okay, yeah. I started hooking up stuff. I said, oh, gee, wait a minute. I forgot where this went. I went to... Before I knew it was 2:30, I said, oh, jeez, I'm going to bed. So as I got ready to turn off the TV, they're showing gunshots and bombs going off on MSNBC, and it said, breaking news.
Right. And you're like,
holy
oh, my God.
What is it? Is this new? What's going on? No.
They must have got him. They
oh, my God. I said, we don't know who it is, but someone just shot an MIT police officer. In his car. Holy cow, what is going on? I said, well, let me see. 4:45 this morning, I said, you know, enough is enough. I found out it was one of the stupid Chechen brothers who got his butt shot and
run over by his other brother. He's got a daggone explosive device on his chest. I said, I saw this on Criminal Minds.
Right.
And I saw the same story on Criminal Minds.
Hey, I was even, look, when I saw it the other day, now this was when they first released the pictures, but you could tell one of them was older, one of them was younger.
Yeah,
you
know,
you saw it, and one of them looked like a kid. You could just, he looked like a teenager.
That's the guy I was looking for.
Right, that's the one still missing. His name is Dozkar. The Sarnayev is their last name, but the Sarnayevs are the two brothers. But anyway, at the time I saw them, and I said it looked almost like a father-son team. And you know what I actually thought about? There was an episode of...
There was an episode of Criminal Minds where a brother and brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also there was an episode one time called Law and Order CI. I think it was with the ones with what's his name? Big giant lug.
The one was in
There was an episode there where they had a father son team where the father led the son. He forced him to do all this stuff, and they went on this killing spree. You know, it's kind of like the DC sniper,
right?
But he was shooting people and doing stuff, and then when they captured the father, the son went ahead and kept acting,
trying
to get him out of him, but he kept terrorizing things. He blew up something and shot people and all this stuff because he had been basically like, you know, it's like brainwashed.
Right.
And when I saw this, I instantly thought that. I was like, oh, this poor, you know, whoever this kid is, you know, he's you know, because you don't just naturally think, hey, I'm a teenager. I think I'm going to bomb a marathon.
His brother was like 7 years older than him.
Yeah. So, you know, you can see the writing on the wall. But, again, it is like these TV shows. It is exactly like, you know, reality is mirroring fiction. And, by the way, speaking of, I have to say this, truth being stranger than fiction, what the F, Mississippi? Every time you make the news, you supersede yourself. You know, not to sound bad, but in a stupid way, you almost long for the days when they were just legitimately burying people in dams, you know, because this moron, I mean, we got now an Elvis impersonator sending ricin poison letters.
You know, I haven't seen him yet.
To Obama and stuff.
Oh, he's
just some. Yeah, they got pictures of him on the internet. His name, what was his name? I've heard none here.
Elvis.
Elvis. No, his name is Paul Curtis. Okay, this guy from Mississippi.
Now, is he a terrorist?
No, he's a moron.
Well, what's the difference between a moron and a terrorist?
A terrorist accomplishes his goal.
Oh, okay.
You see, and then people are terrorized.
Oh.
People are laughing. And this guy, see, this is a guy who, A, mailed letters that didn't hurt anybody because, you know, he's not a very good bioterrorist, you know. But anyway.
Were they ricin?
They're ricin.
Was it ricin?
Yeah, it was ricin, but he just didn't know what he's doing, so he didn't hurt anybody. So he didn't accomplish that. And then secondly, he mails the letters, you know, where they can obviously track them right back to his house because they arrive like the day next.
Return envelope?
Thirdly. The letters that he sent are the same letters he'd been sending for like 3 years or something, they've said, and they've gone back. And then he's got even word-for-word excerpts on his blog. And worse than that, he references in the letters his own book that he's writing against the government. So it's kind of like, yo, dude, you know, at least get a friend to mail it or something. I don't know. You know, you can't
go to another state.
You can't help but feel sorry for the guy. He's stultish. Yeah, he's from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, this whole thing. I mean, Elvis mails poison to the president. And
I know Chris Hayes also last night on his show was talking about the difference between killers and terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He wants to know why. It's a death penalty, and we get not just the National Guard out.
Mm-hmm.
We get the FBI, ATF, DIA, every police law enforcement there is in the world to go after a terrorist versus killers. Now. Here's what I'm trying to say. Terrorism in the last 20 years has killed 3,500 people. Terrorism. guns have killed over 900,000 88 people a day. Now, who are the terrorists?
Right.
Are guns terrorists? The NRA, are they terrorists?
Oh, they're just the gun industry lobbyists, man. Come on.
But are they terrorists?
You can't blame
for
them.
The gun industry.
Oh, you can't blame them for anything.
900,000 plus people have been killed with guns.
Well, see.
And only 3,500 by actual Chechen, Muslim, you name it, terrorists.
Right.
So.
By the way.
But we will not send the National Guard after those people who have shot other people. We will not send the ATF because we can't even get an ATF director.
Yeah, we haven't had one in 4 years.
Longer than 4 years. 8 years. So we can't get any of those, but we will get every mother and brother and sister on this planet to go after a terrorist when a terrorist hasn't done jack.
Yeah.
Compared to
everyday
regular
job.
Everyday.
Yep.
88 plus people a day die.
Yeah.
Since the Connecticut incident, we've had almost 4,000 people killed with guns.
That's what, look, we started two wars with 1,000-something dead in the World Trade Center, right? And we've killed four times that many just since we shot all the children in the elementary school. You know, so what is terrorism? Terrorism is just, whatever the...
whatever you claim it is
of mind.
At the time, right?
Yeah.
It's whatever you claim it is at the time.
Imagine if you see this mobilization in Boston. We've been sitting here looking at these images. We've got every street filled with armor carriers. They've got SWAT, ATF, FBI, all kind of shock troops. It looks like a scene out of
Homeland Security.
Oh,
that's
man.
CIA. You've got the NSA. They're all doing surveillance from black helicopters.
Yeah.
From the helicopters you probably don't even see. They're probably invisible.
I'm waiting for this. Why don't they just say the reason that we didn't catch him and got away is because we were hesitant to use the drone. We could have taken him out with the drone.
That's right. We could have
but it was on our soil. Yeah. Maybe they'll pass that law next. Because of Boston, we could have ended it earlier if we only had domestic drone strikes.
They need to use a drone strike on the NRA headquarters. That's what they need to use, a drone strike. That's where it goes. They need it.
What are you calling for? There's LaPierre.
Yes. Wayne LaPierre needs to be arrested for not just inciting, but for being... And he's not the puppet master, you know.
Oh, he's just a mouthpiece.
He's just a mouthpiece.
It's kind of like
Colt and Remington.
Oh, they're the ones that founded the NRA to begin with.
Right.
The NRA is just their go-by senator's political wing. It's just a lobbying group.
So the thing
these
is...
These guys, look, this is why, and it's real. I mean, from the beginning, did not the widow of the gun dude go and build that mansion full of homes because she was, like, out of her mind because they lamented how many deaths had been caused. Winchester or Colt or whoever those people. I mean, from the get-go, a weapon is a weapon is a weapon. In my question, I've always been, they're always like, but it's our right.
They keep lying. Why do people keep saying, anybody that understands what the second grade of English knows the Constitution says you can have a gun as a involved with a well-regulated militia. One person is not a militia.
Right.
One person is not a militia.
Militia.
So therefore, what gives you the right to have 45 guns?
And also, this whole thing about guns. Because the NRA is only a gun lobby, have you noticed it's always guns? Their right is guns. No, it's not. Right? It doesn't
have
anything to do with it. Yeah, it's
That's what they have no ball.
When it was written, they had barely invented firearms. You had the freaking muskets and let's pack in some powder and take
booby knives.
That's what they had. They used to do
bow and arrow.
You call somebody out and you have a duel. You walk around with a sword on your hip, right? Now, all of that's illegal. You walk 5 minutes in any town with a sword, you're going to be on the ground like eating concrete. Okay, all that stuff's illegal, but yet guns, oh, hey, you can have it, you know, anywhere. Let's, oh, Wild West, let's have one on each hip. Let's have it under our arms, you know, let's go for it. Draw, Mo. This is BS. It's a gun lobby thing. You, otherwise, let's have it all. I want a double-bladed axe on my back. I want a big broadsword. I want guns on every hand. And then I want a rocket launcher on top of my tank as I drive to work.
Well, see, this,
I mean,
this,
give
this,
me a break.
This is the other thing. I can't remember. What are you going to do if SEAL Team 6 is coming into your house after you?
Nothing. You're going
to
die.
How many guns are you going to be able to defend yourself with?
You're going to die.
I mean, you only have two hands?
That's what the other thing, this whole thing. I got to defend myself against my government.
Move! Go to freaking Chechnya!
Yeah, or try French. I hear their people. You know,
yeah.
Look, it's ridiculous.
Give me a freaking break. I'm so sick and tired of these. I mean, the Constitution just says well-regulated militia. That is not one person. It doesn't say well-regulated person.
Exactly.
It says well-regulated militia. A militia is made up of more than one person.
And it's for the defense
of the homeland.
Yes.
Wrong terminology.
It's
homeland.
The fatherland.
The fatherland.
Yeah. it is. So, all right. Let's talk about a few of these news items, though, this week. So we did. We do it 5 minutes.
You got to give it only 2 minutes because we have
important stuff.
Big Gaff is waiting in the wings.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Yes.
We'll cut it down.
All right. Let's cut it down.
We've talked enough about guns. We've talked enough about Elvis and his bad mail. We've talked about the Bomber Boys.
The Bomber Boys.
You know, we even mentioned Cisco and all that stuff. So I'll drop it all. I'll just say this in our final moment.
Yes.
To bring us into a lighter mood. Let's shake off all these bad juju, bad vibes. Okay, shake it off. This week we also found some more exoplanets.
Exoplanets?
Yes.
Oh.
These are planets around other stars.
Weird.
This week,
yeah,
we found three around other stars that are in the habitable zone.
Habitable zone.
They're near Earth zone.
They're near Earth zone.
Yes.
How many light years from here?
Oh, they're thousands of light years away, unfortunately.
Okay.
However, they're doing a survey.
Who's Pat Robertson?
With the Kepler.
Pat Robertson?
No, Pat Robertson. Yeah, he prayed.
The Lord didn't tell him?
Yeah,
that's
no.
Where we're at?
Okay. The Lord would say, I've destroyed all life on other planets so that you can be the only one.
Oh, okay.
Now,
right.
The Kepler system, though, is this fantastic satellite system we're doing. They're doing a massive survey of stars right now. And they're looking for planets, and they're looking specifically for planets in the habitable zone so that we can, you know, not just blindly fly through space and hope to colonize, but colonize intelligently so that we can go to where there might be worlds that are exactly like the Earth.
And when we go,
it's a good thing. I hope soon, but oh no, we keep cutting funding. Gee, willikers, guys. Real life consequences of bad politics.
Real life.
But anyway, I thought it was exceptional news. So we've got three Earth like planets in habitable zones, and two of them they found are around the same star.
Not according to Pat Robertson.
Wouldn't
ain't
that
nothing
be
to have in the universe, but he only reaches in the entire universe.
Well, unfortunately for Pat, it's a very big universe.
Well, but
and there's
he can only see well you got
trillions of galaxies
from his studio
and
the
odds are that there's life everywhere because they found stars around stars by the kajillion everywhere and planets around every star, and now we're finding Earth-sized habitable zone planets around almost all stars. So it's very interesting. Very interesting. Good news.
All right. Well, one quick thing also. Chuck Hagel came back up to the house. He was greeted like royalty.
Chuck.
They said, "Oh, Chuck Hagel, he has been so great as the new DOD chairman. It was a praise. It was praise. They were laughing. They were the Republican who 3 months ago insisted that this former GOP senator was ill-prepared, did not know
also, not just Abraham did not know, but he was in collusion with the people in Iran for giving them money.
Yeah.
Now he's a good guy. These guys are lies. All right.
Oh, they're just pathetic. Hey, let's get to your one of your neat things here. Let me see that book.
Yeah.
I brought you this book.
Yeah. Where's this book? Oh, yeah. Here's this book. And
about this book,
Mr. Gaff, listen to this.
Yes.
I just got this for my birthday. Big George, are you on?
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, how you doing, George?
I just want to tell you.
Happy year, Tom.
Thomas just brought me this book for my birthday.
I got this little book. Now, we're going to jump into your movie on Jackie Robinson, but in honor of that, I found this cool book. You might want to pick it up, too, just mentioning it. But it's called Black Diamond, The Story of the Negro Baseball Leagues. It's by Patricia McKissick and Frederick, the son. So it chronicles everything in the entire leagues, but it does have a whole bunch of Jackie Robinson, because I don't think you can touch baseball without mentioning Jackie.
And it talks about, it says, the history of the Negro Leagues is the story of the legendary heroes such as Cool Papa Bello and Satchel Paige. And they used to call, my father told me about both of them, and he used to call Satchel Paige threw the ball so hard, he used to call it B-ball, because it went by so fast, it buzzed just like a bee. So now I want to tell you, I read Big Gaff's critique of 42, and it had me crying reading his critique of 42.
I'm telling you, you can feel the emotion on this.
It was a major something. I guess this story, and realistically, well, I was reading some of the posts I got from some other people in New York that sent me. I got a bunch of newspaper articles here, and one has a big across the top. It says Robinson. It shows him signing autographs as a kid, the real Jackie Robinson. Then it shows Harrison Ford playing Branch Rickey and the actor playing Jackie. But they also have one here, which it says, "Your New York leading man." Brooklyn's own Jackie Robinson on the big screen in 42. Now, a lot of people don't know, and why, which I'm going to ask you, maybe you might know, George, is why there was only one film ever done on Jackie Robinson, and that had to be with Jackie Robinson playing himself in the film.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is that it was a touchy social issue. You know, that's one thing. I mean, maybe nobody, you know, people had to make money off the movie. They had to make money off the movie, not off of the television rights and the DVDs and all that stuff like that. I mean, it just may have been that. Yeah, I mean, Jackie Robinson, we lived in Brooklyn, so we have a different slant on it, but I mean, like the Jackie Robinson story may not have played very well south of the Mason-Dixon line and things like that out west, you know.
George, Denzel Washington made a film about a drug dealer in Manhattan, in Harlem. I mean, if you're going to make a movie of a black drug dealer in Harlem, how come you could not make a movie about the first person that broke the color barrier in baseball?
Yeah, but I mean, again, if you got a negative image like a drug dealer, that may be something that, in other words, what I'm saying is, believe me, the Tea Party and stuff like that would flock to a picture about a drug dealer more than they would flock to a picture about a black man. It's what's the most scariest thing in the world? An intelligent black man or woman?
Yeah. Well,
that's the thing. If they're holding up, if they're robbing things and shooting drugs and selling drugs and stuff like that, hey, that's feeding into the stereotype. So I could see that. If you're making a movie about a positive black man, and that's not, that, you know, I mean, ask Michelle Bachman and them if they want to go see that.
Well, now, one of the things that was mentioned in one of these articles that you shared with me, Mike, was that the widow, of course, has been holding on to the rights to his story, and she's been waiting for it to be told correctly. So maybe there was also an issue that way, just to,
yeah,
that she was protecting his image.
That very well could be.
Because it says here the director had a really hard time convincing her that he had to really sell it that he was going to do it right and not, you know, mess it up.
Well, you say in your article, George, now I ask you about this, it's about feeling the pain of the character at that level.
Yeah, and have to sit in the dark because of the tears.
Now, what did you mean, feel to, because, you know, there's a lot of us out there, they don't know jack about Jackie Robinson. And, I mean, I guarantee you that probably 50% of the Major League Baseball right now don't know jack about it. So, when you said, feel the pain of the character, you felt his pain.
Well, you know, to me, the number one thing about if you go to a good movie, the number one thing is that you have an emotional involvement. Now, I can't remember, what was I watching? I was watching a picture where it was very well laid out. I can't remember what it was now, but it was very well laid out. They had everything. Technically, you couldn't say they missed any beats in this movie, but you didn't care. You know, like you're watching it,
right,
but you didn't care if they shot this guy. They didn't shoot him. If he was successful, was unsuccessful. You know, it was all laid out fine, but you didn't have a rooting interest. Jackie Robinson, to see any, here's a person, it's just a decent human being, and to see him abused, when he can't go to the bathroom in the gas station. Jackie Robinson was from California, or grew up in California,
right,
and they didn't have the segregation that he saw when he went south to play baseball with the Negro League, and that was his first experience with that, with just pure out-and-out racism and segregation. And one of the scenes is that the bus is taking the team to a game in the south, and they have to stop and they have to get 99 gallons or something. They have to get 90 gallons or something of gasoline. Gasoline was like a nickel a gallon. So when he gets off the bus, he's going to go to the bathroom, and the white attendant pumping the gas, tells him, "Oh, you can't go in that bathroom. You have to go out in the bushes." And he says, "Well, you know what? Stop pumping the gas." He says, "Maybe we shouldn't buy our gas here." And the attendant thinks about it and decides that he'd rather have that money than hold up the traditions of the South. And he lets him use the bathroom. But you just get involved with things like that. You know what I mean? It's just it's emotional. You can't sit there. And this is not a black thing. Any person. I don't go to a movie, oh, they're killing Chinese, or they're killing Europeans, they're killing Egyptians or something. I don't care. I think that's psychotic. I mean, you're a human being. I don't want to see anybody mistreated. And so to see somebody mistreated like that, you should, if you're a decent person, emotionally it's got to affect you, you know. And it's not dramatic. It's just a simple – I mean, this was a routine thing, and that's a shame that this was just a routine thing. It wasn't the drums roll or anything. The guy said, you just can't go to the bathroom, and it wasn't like some kind of decision. It was just a routine, and that kind of abuse. Kids growing up now, and anybody that's growing up after us, you know, wouldn't know about these things. They wouldn't cross their mind.
Right,
kids doesn't go to McDonald's and say, "Oh, I'm lucky I can use the bathroom in McDonald's or something."
Right.
You know, Pizza Hut or whatever.
You said something important there, because you said he was from California and he wasn't used to it. So I guess a lot of the guys on the team he was with in the Negro League couldn't understand why he didn't understand.
Right. That's they were conflicted, right, because they had grown up under that system.
Right.
My cousin Bill Davis coached South Carolina State football. He was the winningest coach at South Carolina State in the football program. And he also played football and starred for Johnson C. Smith in his college days, in his playing days. And And at his funeral, they wanted me to speak, and I said, no, there's so many people who want to speak. So what I did was I wrote out a little vignette, and it was about when Bill and I were going, I was like 12 or something like that, or 11, and he was like 14, and we were going to the down in Union, South Carolina, and we were going to the city hall to get renew his father's driver's license or something, some kind of form we had to pick up, and we were going to the county clerk's office in City Hall in Union, South Carolina, to pick it up. And as we're walking along talking, I stop to have a drink, and Bill keeps walking. He doesn't see me, you know, what I'm doing. He keeps on walking. So I bend over the fountain, and I'm about to take a drink, and out of the corner of my eye, I see something flying towards me. And I turn, and it's Bill. He's flying through the air. He tackled me and knocked me back about 5 feet. And we landed on the ground in the middle of City Hall in the main lobby, and people were walking by, but it didn't bother anybody, because the kids, us being sprawled on the floor, we were young kids, you know, like no old something. It was just children laying on the floor, fooling around, so it didn't bother anybody. It's not like anybody stopped. People just kept walking past us. But he told me, he said, you were about to drink out of the white fountain. And I said, what white fountain? And he showed me that the water cooler that was electrified and refrigerated was the white mark, whites only, and the one that was in the wall, it was just regular water, not refrigerated or anything like that. That was the black fountain. It said colored or something, and the other one said white. And I just saw a water fountain. And then he explained to me. That was the day he explained to me. He said, oh, no, no. He said, you can't drink out of the white fountain. And that's what he was stopping me from doing, by tackling me. And it was so serious, he had to tackle me, because I was just about to reach down to get the water. And on the way home, he explained to me, as we walked home, he explained to me that, oh, that's Mr. Jones's store. Now, if you go in there, you can buy clothes, but you can't try them on. That's Mr. So-and-so's restaurant. You can go to the window and get your food, but you can't go inside and get food. And then the kids, when I taught this in school, the kids always had a problem, because they said, well, Mr. Kev, that doesn't make any sense, because it's not making sense, because there's black people working. It doesn't make sense, because there's black people working in the restaurant. I said, that's the key. They're working. Black people could work in the restaurant. They could cook the food. They couldn't sit down there and eat it. And that was what the kids were conflicted, because they didn't understand that. I said, you know, like you see a movie or something, and you say, well, there's black people working in there. I said, but they work. They don't socialize in there. And so he showed me every store on the way home, and he showed me the movie theater, and he talked about how you have to go on the balcony. And I said, well, I like to sit up in the balcony. And he didn't correct me, but it took me a while to realize that having to sit in the balcony is not the same as choosing to sit in the balcony. Even though that might be where you prefer to sit, but you're not choosing it. You're relegated to it. So anyway, that was a very educational thing, and I wrote that at the funeral rather than stand up and make a speech and add to the many people who wanted to speak. And I just say this, later on, about 3 years later, they did a – Union has a – there's a theater. The little theater group used that vignette. They used that scene I talked about. And they dramatized it and put it on in the play. They put it on as a one-act play to go with other, you know, vignettes. But they dramatized it and showed us, and, you know, the things that I was pointing out, they showed that in a little drama.
Well, the Daily News also had pointed out that without Jackie Robinson, a person like Barack Obama would have been another 25 years out from where we are today.
Yeah, well, if Jackie Robinson had failed, it would have been 50.
Right. Well, yeah.
Without Jackie Robinson even doing anything, it would have been 25 years. But had he got up there and been a buffoon like Barry Bonds, if they found him cheating, taking drugs and all this other stuff.
Let's don't be that way against Barry.
Now let me get this straight. If you get a lot of tattoos, wear a dress, and dye your hair outlandishly, it doesn't make you a better basketball player.
we catch the Dennis Rodman. Well, yeah, but if you remember, if you if you can go and negotiate with foreign governments, that helps redeem your image.
That's true.
But no, again, by showing these people in a competent way. Now, see, this is one thing I want to mention about on your review that you said, because you talked about the harshness, or you gave a warning really, but you said about the language, you know, that they actually do use, racial terms all the time.
Some people today
have trouble with that. However, I'm of agreement, I think, with you. It's just the same way with the same complaints you always hear about, you know, anything driving Miss Daisy or anything else. You know, why do you have to show people in that light, blah, blah, blah. You have to show the truth, you know. And that is so important, I think, to let people realize. It's kind of like some people will put off, you know, those scenes with the, you know, all the joking aside, but the, what was the one they just came up with where the health?
Remember yeah, the movie to help. Right, right.
Got oh, the help, yeah.
In it or how harsh it was. You know what? It was harsh. There were some rough times. And you have to show the full truth. You can't sugarcoat it, or else you don't get the impact.
Right, that's the whole thing, Tom, that impact. When you, and that's why, like, you know, reviewing movies, it's very simple. You sit there for 2 hours and you don't feel any impact. It's just, oh, here they're shooting the vampires. They're blowing up they're blowing up something at the number 10th blow up of a building or something.
And
you watch it, but you're not, there's no impact. But in the health,
right.
When a woman pleads with her boss that she needs $75 to send her kid to college, $75 would give her enough to send the kid to college, change that kid's life. And the woman says, I'm going to help you. This is the boss. The white boss tells her, I'm going to help you. And then later on says, I'm going to help you by not loaning you that money, because that money would put you $75 in debt. So my favor to you is to not loan you the money. And that is impactful. That's more impactful than the 6,790 bullets they fire in the average, gangster movie or something out here.
One of my favorite scenes in Driving Miss Daisy, when it's a kind of quiet scene, but when he turns around and he said, now I'm a grown man. I don't have to ask you to make water.
You go to the bathroom, yeah.
But that is more powerful than, like you said, all the car chases and explosions in the world.
And that's in the Jackie Robinson story. There's no physical abuse of him. Nobody puts a hand on him. But you can see the psychological damage that people are trying to do to him with the bathroom, with getting on an airplane, with just,
right.
You know, anything, just intimidating him without ever touching. He's never physically assaulted. He's just constantly being intimidated, and he won't, or attempts are made to intimidate him. But, he perseveres. But you can't sit there. You cannot sit there and not be moved by that.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. You and Mikey both alluded to my opening line was that I'm glad, in my review I said, I'm glad that movies are shown in the dark, because
yep.
It wouldn't do me well to have all the people there see the tears in my eyes throughout the picture. But I'm telling you now, there's something wrong with you if you don't have tears in your eyes.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is that I want to know about Chris Maloney, who played Leo Durocher, because Leo Durocher, I mean, he set the whole thing in motion, and he told the guy, said, I remember which ball player was, but he was the year before, I think he was either the batting champion or the close to the batting champion, and he told them, if you do not want this man to play on the team, I'm trading you, because he's going to win us the pennant. Now, do they do enough to show Leo Durocher was a major figure in Jackie Robinson's history?
Well, they showed. Now, what they did was this. The 1950 production, if people don't know about that, the 1950, they made, Jackie came up in 47, In 1950, they made the Jackie Robinson story. He played himself. Ruby Dee played his wife. And they had a very sugar-coated version of what DeRosa said. And that was that the team had come to DeRosa with a petition saying that they didn't want to play with Robinson. They didn't want to play on a team with a black player. And it was signed by X number of players. Not everybody, but it was signed by a majority. So in the early version, and they don't point out that it's Leo DeRosa. I don't think in the early version they ever use his name, but they say just the manager or something. But anyway, he points out that he says to the players, he says, well, you know, it's kind of strange. You don't want Robinson, whose family has lived here for 400 years or 300 years, to play on your team. Yet, and he pointed out, he said, Cinelli or something, you're from Italy. Your parents just got here, you know, 15 years ago. And he didn't point out the next guy. He said, you're from France and you're from Greece. And he pointed out to all the white teachers that they are white players that they had come from foreign countries. Didn't, you know, and they said, this man was here, his family was here, and yet you deny him a chance to earn a living in America, and you came here to earn a living, and, you know, there's something wrong with that. That was the 1950 version, and that was very upbeat. Now, DeRosa, like you said, in the new version, Christopher Maloney plays DeRosa, and he tells the players flat out. He says, you get used to it. He said, these black players are hungry. They've come up the hard way. They can play baseball. And they're gonna, a lot of them are gonna be better than you, and you have to face that. He didn't sugarcoat it. He didn't say, "Well, it's only." He said Jackie Robinson is the first, but he won't be the last. And he told him, he said, "And if you can't play with him, then you can't play here because he is gonna take us to the next level." And that's it. Right. And he did not try to. He did not sit there and say, "Well, I understand." He didn't do any of that. You can leave because. You know, you'll just speed up this. If you leave, there'll be a black player taking your place a little sooner than if you stay. But he said the black players are coming, and you're an idiot if you don't see it coming, because in baseball, ultimately, you have to win. Nobody in baseball can keep their job if they don't win.
And baseball, and he told them that. And baseball was slavery, because they didn't have no union, and they held you in bondage. You didn't go nowhere, or you didn't play with anybody unless you played for them or where they wanted you to play back then. And the thing is that so they didn't have any no-trade contracts. They didn't have any of that nonsense. I mean, you were operating under their domain, the owner's domain back then. And you got to remember, for Leo DeRosa, hard-nosed ball player, he will win at all costs. He's the one that said, if I was the third baseman on a team and my mother was on second base and she was going to score with the winning run, I'd trip her when she rounded third base. So his whole idea is to win, period. And they said also, and I can't remember, I was trying to find the place here in this, all these articles I have. They said, you know, Brooklyn was the place for Jackie Robinson to go. They said because they had all nationalities and ethics in Brooklyn. It wasn't like going to the Giants or going to the Yankees where you didn't have that. And the thing is, in baseball, there was only one color, and that was Dodger blue.
Well, the other thing was this. They didn't try to sugarcoat this thing with the thing, too. Branch Rickey said there's a lot of black people that would buy tickets to these games. So money's involved. It's not like, oh, let's go out and go through a lot of turmoil to do a social good. There's money to be made. We got a fan base, like you said, Brooklyn, with the had all ethnic groups. You have a fan base that's going to come and generate new income for the team. So, you know, if Italians like chocolate ice cream, I'm going to sell chocolate ice cream. I mean, that's the way it works. He said it's money, too. They didn't try to make out like, oh, this is just a noble thing. This was about making money. And that makes sense. This was a picture, I'm telling you now, it's a very good picture, because it doesn't pander. It doesn't make anybody out to be a superhero. It shows the struggle of the people around him. That they showed the fact that Jackie couldn't stay at hotels. He had to stay with families. They would go to a game. He would have to stay with a family. Usually it would be a prominent family that had room in their house and could accommodate, you know, him coming there and staying with them. And also the fact that it was a prominent family, you know, gave a credibility to, like it'd be a minister or somebody's house, and that he had some stature with the white community, they'd be less likely to attack him in a doctor's house or a minister's house and stuff like that, rather than if it was somewhere in the, you know, obscure out somewhere where the Klan, because they threatened to come, the Klan would threaten to come and attack him if he stayed in town. It was it was just a very emotional picture, I'm telling you.
I'd say bring off Pee Wee Reese in the
well, first of all, one of the greatest pictures I've ever seen is Sling Blade with Billy Bob Thornton. It's about the guy who would I don't want to go into the plot of Sling Blade, but it's a wonderful picture. And the boy who played the child actor in that, Lucas Black, plays Pee Wee Reese. And I know if you've seen Sling Blade, you'll realize from this guy's voice and stuff that you know him, but you'll never remember that he was this little kid. This is 20 years later. And you never remember that he was a little kid. But they show that Pee Wee Reese was the captain of the Dodgers. He was from the South, but he bought totally into what DeRosa said. He said Pee Wee Reese realized that this is, you know, he was from the South, and people assumed that he would support segregation and that he would be on the sign the petition and all this to keep Robinson off the team, and he didn't do that. He was the captain of the team, and he said, I'm the captain of the team. I'm not the captain of the white players or the black players. I'm the captain of the team. And he supported Robinson, and there was one game when they went south, and because Cincinnati is a southern place. And people don't realize that Cincinnati, Ohio, but it's a southern place. It's right on the water across from Kentucky. So when they went there, they showed that Pee Wee Reese, Robinson was being booed and different things like that. And Pee Wee Reese went over to like have a conversation with him, like, you know, like, and as he had the conversation, he just stood next to him and put his arm around him and was talking to him. And that just gave Robinson, you know, the crowd couldn't, if he's all right with Pee Wee Reese, he's got to be all right with us.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is, though, and a lot of people don't understand that Robinson had more problems with racists in Philadelphia than he did in Cincinnati.
Oh, well, that's one of the most vicious parts of the picture. That's the one when I talk about the language. Because the manager of the Phillies was Ben Chapman was just open. I mean, he was out and out racist, and I mean, he just goes off in a diatribe, calling Robinson every name under the sun, and it's not sexual cursing; it's racial cursing. But you know, and then later on, when the press said, aren't you over the line and stuff like that? He says, oh, no, I treat him like everybody else. He says, when DiMaggio comes, we call him a WOP, a Dago, and when so-and-so comes, we call him a Jew, a kike, and stuff like that. So he's defending his racism by saying it's spread out to everybody. So he's equal opportunity racist. It's not that he's not denying he's a racist. He's an equal opportunity racist.
equal opportunity.
Wow.
Well, that's he spread it around a lot. He said, "Now, what do you think first of all, before I ask you that, the actor who played Robinson
the actors are mostly unknown. Harrison Ford is Christopher Maloney. You wouldn't even recognize because." His appearance with the shaved head and everything like that for DeRosa, his appearance wouldn't tell you. You wouldn't be sure you'd say you know this guy from Law and Order, Special Victims Unit, and plus he's not that well known anyway, but except for the TV audience. And they wouldn't recognize him, a lot of people. And he's so, boy, but I'm telling you, he's really so much bigger than DeRosa was. But anyway, it's the acting is superb because you know why? Because the story carries itself, unless you are just unusually bad actor, with this material, and no one person carries it, and it's good that they use a mostly unknown cast. The cast is mostly unknown, and that's great, too, because that way you see the people as who they're supposed to be in the movie. You're not sitting there saying, oh, that's the guy from, James Bond or something. These people, basically, that helps them that they're unknown. They're mostly unknown in the lead, the actor, and they're all good because, you know why? Because the story flows. You don't have to be a great actor to play something that rings so true. They're not asking somebody to stand up and go into Hamlet's soliloquy in the middle of the movie. People are doing things. They're doing things that are realistic. And, as you know, I mean, you could put almost anybody in there in a sense that they're not asking you to fake it. I mean, when the man gets out, Jackie's enraged by the way his wife is treated or something like that, you don't have to, you know, you can drum up that emotion. You can understand the situation and become incensed and pull it off. So the acting is not even an issue. The acting is fine. And I can't fault the pitch anyway, but again, it's the emotions of it. To see the injustice is just overwhelming. And
One of the articles we were reading earlier talked about Chadwick and the director and all, when he was auditioning different actors. And he said all of the actors, he had them all audition the scene where Jackie Robinson breaks down, gets so angry, he goes into the dugout and breaks the bat. He said, I had to do that as the audition. And he said everybody else played it safe. You know, they wanted to get the role. He said they were scared to break out. And he said he was the only one that went from broke and just played pure emotion and just did a gut-wrenching, over-the-top, you know, just tore soul out. And he said that's why he got the role, because of the emotion, whereas all the others tried to act.
Yeah, now, that scene, and that is some scene, I'm telling you, when he just can't, he's so incensed, he goes under the clubhouse walkway and just goes crazy. But nobody could pin up their emotions that long. It was a very well written scene because it would have to be. You'd have to have some point where you release all that thing, and then that scene was very powerful. But it was one of many powerful scenes in the picture. But you had to empathize. It went on long enough for you to realize that this wasn't just thrown in there. Oh, well, let's kill off a few seconds. It was in there because this man had to release all this emotion that was pent up from the abuse he took, because he was told he could not show hostility towards whites for anything that was done to him, because they would always blame him if a fight started. He said, no matter what happens, if a fight starts, they're going to say you started it. And every newspaper is going to show the second punch. They're going to show you hitting back. They'll never show the punch of the guy hitting you. They'll only show the punch of you hitting him. He said, you'll always be the attacker, and he was explaining this. And the other thing was that some people don't realize Jackie Robinson's education and his military status and everything like that. He was an officer. He was the right man at the right place to pull this off. Well, he knew that things were bigger than sports, what he was doing.
But see, now a lot of people don't know, because a lot of people weren't from Brooklyn and they didn't have TV coverage back then.
Well, he was playing a young Jackie Robinson. He looked like he was as tall or something. He wasn't as heavy as Jackie was, but again, I think we're seeing Jackie. This is 1945. This is not even when the picture starts. So I don't think Jackie was as heavy. He was a big man. I mean, he's a big young guy. He's not a heavy guy like you. As Jackie was down the stretch, he wasn't as heavy. But he physically he looked like he was physically able to do what he does in the picture. Get emotionally involved with all the characters, you know. You get emotionally involved with the characters that were against Robinson, because they were emotional too. They have a scene where they show you Dixie Walker, I think, was the player you were trying to figure out that was a good hitter, and they DeRosa told him he could get off the team, you know. And they show how, you know, they showed that they were conflicted too, because, like you said, when they were told that they couldn't stay on the team if they wouldn't play with Robinson, they couldn't stay on the team. You know, they had to reexamine themselves, and then most of them tried to say that it wasn't them; it was their friends. You know, that my people back at home wouldn't expect, people back in Alabama, Mississippi and stuff wouldn't understand me playing with a black player. And they, you know, they tried to say that personally it wasn't them. You know, after a while, that was one of their things, that it wasn't, they were being driven by the people around them.
Well, Dixie Walker went 5-5 when Roy Campanella came in, so that was the guy that took his place.
Yeah. Well, they mentioned that Robinson would be first. They mentioned Campanella and Newcomb coming up. They said, we got two other guys coming up, and, you know, they mentioned them and said, but Robinson should be the first one because he had the best chance of dealing with all the issues by the fact that he was from California, and he knew how things could be. He knew that things didn't have to be segregated, and also he knew, you know, he had the discipline to not fight back and you know, get thrown out of games or do anything or have any kind of drinking problems or anything like that.
Well,
you know, he had to be
you,
perfect.
I want to thank you, Big George. That was a great article you wrote.
Yes. Next week. I can't hear you over the music. I can't hear you.
How many years is this now going to the
Pennsylvania? Oh, 1961 was the first year. And that was the year Wingate won the national championship in the mile relay.
Okay. That's George Cafferty with his. And where can we read your article, Big Cap?
You have to go online. I don't want to give out that blog number again because it's hard to give out blog numbers on the radio. But I'm published in a Brooklyn paper now and online. Yeah,
right.
Give it out. Put it on the website for me.
Alrighty. That's it from The Last Words. Mike Lawson, Thomas Cornberry, and Big George Cap. Giving us a review on 42. Go out and see it. You're going to love it. Good night.